Shri Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopinath Shyama Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Ki Jai Vrindavan Dham Ki Jai Dur Dham Ki Jai Navadvip Mayapur Dham Ki Jai Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Jai Gangamai Jumuna Devi Ki Jai Bhakti Devi Ki Jai Tulsi Maharani Ki Jai Samaveta Bhakti Vrinda Ki Jai Gaur Premanand All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Stai Vidlation Mati Bhakti Mantra Swami Mati Namane. Namaste. Saraswati Deva Vandana Vichandi Vasasa Sama Vipasita Vasitana. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Vita Parakama Sri Guru Vaishnavam Shri. Shri Rupam Sahajatam Sahagana Ravimitam Vikram Stam Sajiva Sadvaitam Sabritam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Ravita Shri Kshatanakatam Sja Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya So it's April 22nd, 2009. We're at the Loft in Auckland, and we're going through Bhagavad Gita, chapter 14, text 14 through 27. Read it together. Everybody's ready? Text 14 of chapter 14. The one-handed suck. Okay. When one dies in the mode of goodness, he attains to the pure higher planets of the great sages. When one dies in the mode of passion, he takes birth among those engaged in fruitive activities. And when one dies in the mode of ignorance, he takes birth in the animal kingdom. The result of pious action is pure and said to be in the mode of goodness, but action done in the mode of passion results in misery, and action performed in the mode of ignorance results in foolishness. From the mode of goodness, real knowledge develops. From the mode of passion, greed develops. And from the mode of ignorance, develop foolishness, madness, and illusion. Those situated in the mode of goodness gradually go upward to the higher planets. Those in the mode of passion live on the earthly planets. And those in the abominable mode of ignorance go down to the hellish worlds. When one properly sees that in all activities, no other performer is at work than these three modes of nature, and he knows the Supreme Lord, who is transcendental to all these modes, he attains my spiritual nature. When the embodied being is able to transcend these three modes associated with the material body, he can become free from birth, death, old age, and their distresses, and can enjoy nectar even in this life. Arjuna inquired, "Oh, my dear Lord, by what symptoms is one known who is transcendental to these three modes? What is his behavior, and how does he transcend the modes of nature?" The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, O son of Pandu, he who does not hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they are present, or long for them when they disappear, who is unwavering and undisturbed through all these reactions of the material qualities, remaining neutral and transcendental, knowing that the modes alone are active, who is situated in the self and regards alike happiness and distress, who looks upon a lump of earth, a stone, and a piece of gold with an equal eye, who is equal toward the desirable and the undesirable, who is steady, situated equally well in praise and blame, honor and dishonor, who treats alike both friend and enemy, and who has renounced all material activities. Such a person is said to have transcended the modes of nature. One who engages in full devotional service, unfailing in all circumstances, at once transcends the modes of material nature and thus comes to the level of Brahman. And I am the basis of the impersonal Brahman, which is immortal, imperishable, and eternal, and is the constitutional position of ultimate. So here again, we're dealing with a big picture of the modes. You could say a summary. We're not looking at the details. And here, we're looking at the result. Right? Instead of like defining, we're defining something really by its result. Sometimes it's said you can judge something by its result. Thank you. So Krishna's here talking about the result in terms of the next life and the result in terms of your general life. And after describing this, and then, of course, Krishna again says what he said previously, that everything we think is going on here is just the modes of nature. It's not you really doing something, it's just the modes of nature doing something. And if you understand this, and you understand that you're transcendental to the modes, then you can also attain, he says, to my. And then Arjuna, like a good disciple is supposed to do, Pariprashnena, he asks questions. And he asks, he has three questions. He asks, what are the symptoms, what are the behavior, and how do you do it? So symptoms means your internal symptoms. What are you experiencing internally? Behavior, what can other people see, and how do you do it? And then Krishna says, you do it by engaging in devotional service to me in all circumstances. And if you do that, he said, you'll attain to Brahman, and someone may say, well, why just Brahman? And he says, well, I'm the basis of the Brahman. Okay. Going to text 14, what interesting thing do you notice about text 14? Where Krishna says that if you die in the mode of goodness, you go to the higher planets. You know something interesting in regard to what we studied last week? What did Prabhupada say last week about somebody in the mode of goodness? They take birth over and over again as what? Well, that's a good guess. Don't you remember last week we were talking about how it's possible to have, I mean, not that there is such a thing as material happiness in a sense. In one sense, material happiness doesn't make any sense. But the only thing that is material happiness is the mode of goodness. And it is possible to take birth over and over again in the mode of goodness. And what did Prabhupada say? Someone in the mode of goodness can take birth over and over again as a? He said a philosopher or a poet. Mm-hmm. Remember that? Scientists also, probably. Okay, I think it's text six. Mm-hmm. Repeatedly, one may become a philosopher, a scientist, or a poet. So, in other words, one can take birth over and over again as a philosopher, scientist, poet. I mean, though obviously that's not the only options. It could also be priest. I mean, there's a lot of... Those are not the only Brahmins. Okay, those are not the only people in the mode of goodness. How would you relate what Prabhupada said in that purport to this verse?
You know, that those lovely scientists and poets are here.
On the Earth planet.
Yeah, and Krishna says here, it turns pure higher planets.
Right, of the great sages. Uttama Vidam, of the supremely intelligent. Let's also look at text 18. Now, if we look at the Sanskrit, urdhvam means upwards. Gacchanti is to go. Sattvasta, those who are in the mode of goodness, they go upwards. And Prabhupada puts a word here in the translation.
Gradually
puts the word gradually. So what can we understand about the destination? Let's put all that together. Let's put together text 6, text 14, and what was that? Text 18. Put that all together and tell me what happens to people who are in the mode of goodness. Purport to text 6, text 14, and text 18. So what happens to people in the mode of goodness?
They become philosophers and scientists, and then if they keep on that, if they keep maintaining the mode of goodness, they eventually reach the higher planet.
Okay, that sounds like a good understanding. So they can take birth over and over again on this earth planet as philosophers, scientists, and poets, and if they maintain the mode of goodness, they can go to the higher planets eventually. Now, how long that eventually is probably varies from individual to individual. Some people probably go to the higher planets after one life in goodness, and some after several. But we're looking then at three options. You can take birth again on this planet in the mode of goodness. You can take birth again on this planet in the mode of goodness with the idea you're gradually going upward. Or you can immediately take birth on the higher planets. Among the higher planets also, And there's gradations. So in the higher realms of the universe, there's also the four varnas. There's Brahman, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras. So Brahma and the sages like Grigu, they're Brahmanas. And then there are higher planets where Brahmins live. You can read about this in great detail in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, a most wonderful, wonderful book, where Gopakumar goes gradually up to Goloka Vrindavan from the earth planet. He keeps going to gradually higher and higher and higher places. And he doesn't go to any of the lower heavenly planets, but he goes to Indra's planet, and then he goes from there to the planets of the Prajapatis, and he goes from there to the planets of the sages, and he goes from there to Lord Brahma's planet. So Indra, of course, is a Kshatriya. He's the head of the universe as a king. Brahma is the chief Brahmana, and Indra is the chief Kshatriya. Kuvera is the chief Vaishya. I'm not sure who's the chief Sudra, maybe Chitrarata. But there's also Shudras, the Gandharvas, the Apsaras, the Shudras. But they're heavenly Shudras. They're not, you know, workers like on this planet. Anyway, so going to the higher planets, there's also gradation, where you can go. There's so many planets. So it depends on not just, you know, we're speaking in a very general way here, the mode of goodness, but everything is very individual. But in general, someone in the mode of goodness is going up. You can say in a general way that they're going up. Even if they're sustaining their position, they're doing that sattvastha. If you stay in goodness, you tend to go up. That's the tendency. Okay? All right. And Prabhupada mentions here in the purport where great sages and devotees live. So the people on the higher planets are also theistic people. They believe in God. Now, to what extent they believe in God and to what extent they're religious, exactly, again, that depends. You know, there are many people on the higher planets who, they worship Krishna, they believe in God, they're religious people, but they're mostly interested in sense enjoyment. They're interested in righteous sense, in goodness sense enjoyment. And then there are the great sages on the higher planets, like Tapaloka and Janaloka, who aren't interested in sense enjoyment at all. Some of them are interested in mental sense enjoyment. But some of them aren't interested in that at all. But then you have to go really high up in the universe. That's like where the four Kumaras live.
Do most people or living entities in the mode of goodness, do they believe in God, or can atheists also?
Could an atheist be in the mode of goodness? That's a very good question. You know, in the Bhagavatam, it talks about the subterranean heavenly planets. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm going to answer that with a yes. When Sataputta Prabhu did his research on aliens, have any of you read his book, Alien Identities? Very interesting book. He was looking at the accounts in Arshastras of other planets and beings from other planets. And he was bringing in what empirical evidence exists in the world for the fact that there are living entities on other planets, both higher and lower. And the Bhagavatam describes that there are what's called subterranean heavenly planets. They're outside of the reach of sunlight. But they're described as being more opulent than Indra's heaven. I don't know if that's a literal description. That sort of you'll find that sort of description often. Oh, it's more opulent than Indra's heaven. I'm not sure if that's, you know, if it's a way of describing things or if it's specifically literal. But it's described that there are demons there who are atheists. And they don't get old. They have practically no disease. And because there's no sunlight there, they have no sense of the passing of time. It's always night, which is what demons like, by the way. Demons are interested in the night. And everything's lit up artificially with jewels. Again, I was thinking, when I read that, I always think about Las Vegas. Remember I talked about Las Vegas? Mm-hmm. So always the subterranean heavenly planets always remind me of Las Vegas. Or any of the big cities. I don't know if it's like that here in Auckland. I haven't been around Auckland at night. But in most of the world's big cities, at night, the city sometimes comes alive in a different way. There's neon lights. Do you have that kind of places here? Nightclubs and theaters. And in London, we do Harinam Sankirtan on Saturday night. It's really nice. And the city is as alive at 10 o'clock at night as it is at 10 o'clock in the morning. New York is also like that. There's just as much traffic, just as many people on the streets. And there's all these artificial lights. And so the subterranean heavenly planets or something like that, it's always night. Now, how does somebody get to go there? It's an abode for demons. There's a religion that demons tend to have, and Sataputra brings this up in his book, Alien Identities. They tend, think about the demons that Krishna kills. Where do they go? They usually merge into the Brahmajati. And there are many demons who have a religion of worshipping the Brahman, of wanting to merge into the Brahman. It's a way of becoming God. And many of the, what Sataputra found is that there were accounts that many of these demoniac beings in the universe teach impersonalism, which he said was a big surprise to him. He didn't expect that, you know, aliens from other dimensions who interact with humans were going to be teaching impersonalism. But, you know, merging into the Brahman is also considered in the mode of goodness, if that's your aspiration. And a lot of demons and atheists, they do a lot of austerities. And their aim is to merge into the Brahman. So, yeah, I would say yes. I mean, one thing that I like about that is that Krishna is very fair. He really doesn't discriminate against even those who are envious of him. You know, generally, I do that. If somebody is envious of me or somebody speaks badly of me, you know, I don't want to give them even what they're due. I don't even want to be fair to them. It's like if somebody's my friend, I don't want to be fair to them either. I want to give them more than what they deserve. I want to give them special. It's called nepotism, where you put your friends and family members in positions of authority even if they're not qualified. So our general tendency is if somebody's my friend or family, that I give them something that's especially good even if they don't deserve it. And if somebody's my so-called enemy, then I'll give them something. I want them to have something bad even if they deserve something better. Isn't that the general tense? I get upset if somebody gets something that they deserve, that they work for and they deserved, if there's somebody who doesn't like me. So Krishna's not like that. He doesn't have any envy. He doesn't have any feeling of friends or enemies. I mean, just like demons who perform austerities to get powers. And you might wonder, why does Krishna sometimes let demoniac people be in control? Because they earned it. Now, if they misuse it, he has all kinds of tricks so he can get them out of that position faster than they would have otherwise. Like with Hiranyakashipu, he, you know, gives him a pure devotee as a child that he then mistreats. And that's another part of the law. You can't mistreat a saintly person. You know, if you mistreat a saintly person, then, you know, everything you've earned goes out the window. And we have that in mundane life also. You know, if you've earned the right to have a big political position or to be a professor, and then you do certain criminal activities, you can immediately lose your position. Immediately. When I was studying in graduate school, one of my best classes was how to evaluate teachers, how to appraise teachers, whether they're doing a good job or not, and how do you deal with bad teachers. And especially teachers have, in most parts of the world, something called tenure, where after you work for a certain number of years, it's very hard to fire you. They get like a secure occupation. So he said, what happens if you had a teacher who was very good and gets tenure, and then they're stuck in that position, and then something happens and they become a bad teacher? I mean, maybe they had some personal catastrophe in their life. You know, maybe their husband died or something, and they just stopped caring anymore. And, you know, you might feel sad for them, but you don't want the kids to be stuck with the bad teacher. And then we're talking about how to get rid of them, and then he said, you know, what you really hope is that you find the teacher, like, having sex with the secretary under the table, or so that you can just immediately get rid of them. You understand? So it's the same way Krishna often deals with demons who get in positions of power. He sets them up so that they'll likely do, you know, one really heinous act, and then he can get them out even though otherwise they're qualified. Yes, thank you for that question. Okay. So going on to 15. And here in the mode of passion, where do you take birth if you're in the mode of passion?
Engage in fruitful activities.
Which is where?
Yes, on the earth. So you can take birth again on the earth. And if you die in the mode of ignorance, you take birth animals. Where else could you take birth in the mode of ignorance besides an animal? Lower planets. Yeah, you could become one of the yakshas and rakshasas. And again, why would some go one way and one? It's very individual. But you're going to go down. I mean, what does it says here? Mudha yonishu, which Robert translates as being an animal species. Yonishu means birth. Mudha means foolish. So some kind of foolish birth. And Prabhupada says here in the purport, those who are actually serious about human life should take to the mode of goodness, and in good association transcends the modes. So otherwise, there's no guarantee the human being will again attain to the human status. And of course, in modern society, where the standard of success is the mode of passion, and there's so much propagation of the mode of ignorance, so much, a lot of people are going to be taking birth in the lower species or as demoniac beings. You can see that there are people who want that. They actively want that. They don't find it frightening. Well, they think it would be good. That way they'll just be an animal. I think it was here in New Zealand where I saw a billboard of advertising blue jeans, and it showed a woman who was acting like a tiger. She's leaning over at a pond drinking water out of the drinking water like a tiger, and I think it was a tiger next to her or something. Bring out your animal nature or something like that, and they think that that's a positive thing. Or when I was preaching at the Woodstock Festival in Poland, and we did our Hari Nam around the festival grounds, and there were these people listening to these, I suppose you could call it music, but it looked like wolves growling. That was their, that was what they were listening to. It was shocking for me. I don't know, I'm kind of out of touch with that stuff, and it was really shocking. And they were, of course, all dressed in black. And oh, Krishna, Krishna.
So taking birth in animal species, could that also mean like humans living like animals, because we see so many degraded humans?
It could be. When you go up through the species, Prabhupada says that when you come back up to the human birth, that those who are going to take birth as human beings in goodness were cows in their previous life. Those who take birth as human beings in passion were lions, and those who take birth as human beings in ignorance were monkeys. And also it's very common for a first birth in the human species after the animal species to be as a tribal. Tribal societies are not held as accountable for their sinful activities because they're really going up. Just like animals are not held accountable for their activities basically at all. There's no car. Animals aren't getting any karma. You know, the pukikos aren't getting karma for pecking the other pukikos. You know, there's no illicit sex life in the pukiko society. But among uncivilized human beings, among tribals, there's not so much consideration of sin. It's a step. I mean, you could see that it would kind of be a real shock if you're in a monkey body and then, boof, next life you're in a human body. And you're expected to behave yourself. So there's like an intermediate. Of course, modern society is doing great injustice to most tribal people. One of the biggest problems everywhere in the world is the injustice is done in modern society to tribals. So they're artificially brought. I mean, obviously, if you're a human being, you're a human being, and you have the capacity for self-realization. So even if you're a human being in a tribal society, like there's the chief of the tribals, Guha, who is a great devotee of Lord Ramachandra. So even if you're born in a tribal society, you can certainly come to the highest platform of self-realization. But generally, it's meant as an intermediate step between animal life and human life. And by forcibly taking those people into so-called civilization, they don't generally do very well. I mean, this is a not spoken about, you know, politically incorrect thing to talk about. But all of us in education know it very well. Everybody in education knows that the kids who do worse in education are from tribal cultures. I don't care what tribal culture it is, I don't care what part of the world it is. That's what it is. And I know in America, if you can get children from such cultures to function at average is considered a great victory. If they can be at the 50th percentile, then you're doing really, really well. Again, individuals are individuals. So would it be possible, the reason I'm bringing up about tribals, is it possible for people going down to take birth as a tribal rather than as an animal? I would assume yes. Or like a bum? Could you take birth over and over again like as a bum? Like you can take birth over and over again.
Or is a bum going down or coming down?
Probably some are going down and some are going up. It's just like the animals. Some animals you see are going down and some are going up. Right? On the heavenly planet, some are going up, some are going down. Wherever you look, some people are going up, some people are going down. So that makes sense. You could also take birth over and over again in some low level of human life. And these are generalities. They're not. You can't take this thing that Krishna says this in the Bhagavad Gita, so that means everybody who dies in the mode of goodness is going. Because also remember that there isn't such a thing as pure goodness and pure ignorance, and as we'll read in the next what's the next purport? Where is it? No, it's in 18. The Prabhupada said that it's very rare you find any pure mode. Again, pure goodness is spiritual. Pure ignorance is matter, is dead matter. And it's very rare to find someone in pure passion. Each of us is a unique combination. We're influenced by a unique combination of the modes. So in general, you know, we're like all of us are women. So in general, a woman's body is a particular combination of the modes. But each of us also have our particular combination. And then there are women who are Brahmins, who are Kshatriyas, who are Vaishyas, and who are Shudras. So you've got your general template. Okay, the general template is woman's body has got this particular mix. And then a Brahmin woman's body has a little different mix. And a Kshatriya woman's body, a little different mix. And a Vaishya woman's body, a little different mix. And a Shudras woman's body, a little different mix. And then each of us in that category, we're a little different. I'm a little different than you. And that's the differences between me and you that are manifest right now are mostly, we're not mostly manifesting our spiritual nature. Do you understand? I have a spiritual personality, but that's not really very manifest right now. It's sleeping. So the differences we're seeing are the different combination of the modes that we have. So, you know, you have three modes, and you mix them together, you get 9. 3 times 3 is 9. And then you mix 9 times 9, you get 81. And then you have the three modes as there are, that's 84. That's why there's 8,400,000 species. And then again, each individual is a particular mixture. Just like an artist can take three colors, right? And make thousands and millions of colors from that. So in general, if you're in the mode of ignorance, you're going down. You're in the mode of goodness, you're going up. And in your mode of passion, you're staying. That's a general summary. How exactly you're going down, how exactly you're going up. If you're going up, do you take birth again as a philosopher on the earth planet? Do you go to the Gandharva Loka? Do you go to Indra's planet? Are you going to Bhrigu's planet? And I think it's the same with the mode of ignorance. You know, where are you going? Are you taking birth in some low-class family, human family, where, you know, your mother's a crack addict? Or are you taking birth as a tribal? Or are you taking birth as a pukiko? Or are you taking birth as a fly? Or are you going to the lower planets? That's an interesting birth. Some of those entities on the lower planets have a lot of powers. So it's very, like it says that the Yamadutas, you familiar with the Yamadutas? Yamaraj is they're the agents of Yama or death, and they're very ugly. And they come and they practically scare people out of their body and they drag them to Yamaraj. And it's explained, I think it's in the Garuda Purana. Now, these were very pious people whose children or grandchildren or great-grandchildren stopped performing the sacrifices to keep them on a higher planet. And they're very angry. And so what are they very angry at? They're very angry at impious people. Really, really, really angry because their own descendants became impious and didn't keep them there. You follow? So they really like to punish impious people. But they themselves are not entirely impious. Otherwise, it wouldn't be working for Yamaraj. It's not like they're just criminals. But they have a lot of anger. And that anger gives them a body that's really ugly, although there's a lot of people in the modern age who try to dress up like Yamadutas, you know, with hair standing on end and different colors, and, you know, I mean, all kinds of, that's Yamaduta. That's, of course, a little lesson that if you become very angry at people who are sinful in a self-righteous way, you may become a Yamaduta. You think, gotta be careful. Anyway, my point is there's a lot of variety. But the Hare Krishna is giving us a general principle. You know, if you're in passion, he says, karma sangishu, the association of those engaged in fruitive activities. And if you're in tamasi, if you're in ignorance, muta yangishu, you take have birth in some foolish situation. Okay. 16. So the main point here is that how we can tell we're advancing is whether or not we're free of passion and ignorance. And this is a very, very important purport for preaching. First of all, Prabhupada talks a lot here about animal killing, and especially about killing of cows, and how that people who are killing animals are preparing for birth in animal species, and that it's in the mode of ignorance. Of course, people in modern society often don't think animal killing is in the mode of ignorance. They just don't think about it. Devotee sent me a video the other day of some cow who was being led to slaughter and ran away and was saved by some animal rights group, was brought to an animal shelter where they didn't usually get cows. They usually got like dogs and cats. And one of the ladies working at the animal shelter, who was taking care of this cow for a while until the cow could be relocated to a farm where she wouldn't be killed, she said that she had never before had a relationship with a cow, and that from then on she wasn't going to eat meat anymore. You know, she just didn't think of the cow as an animal, as a living being. Well, an amazing story also one of my friends just recently sent me was of this woman who, she and her family raised cows for slaughter. I think they were also milking them. I think they were raising dairy cows that they also sent for slaughter. And the woman was saying how she thought of the cows like her own children, that she really loved going and feeding them every day and taking care of them. She said that several times, that she thought of them as her own children. And then you think, you know, but how can you kill them? And she described how one day when she went out to feed them, that one cow just went mad and attacked her severely. You know, was throwing her against her truck. And all the other cows went around in a circle and were watching. Anyway, she survived with, you know, long-term injuries. But I was thinking, you know, the cows were angry at her. What are you doing? You know, you're acting like you love us, and then you're sending us to slaughter. So people don't think like this. And yesterday I was thinking about cheeseburgers. How it's practically obscene to eat a cheeseburger. You know, you're taking the cheese from the milk of the cow, and you're eating it with her flesh. Right? It's practically an obscene thing to eat. Horrible. Actually, in the Bible, it says that one should not take the meat of an animal from which you get the milk. And the people who observe that usually say that, well, that means you shouldn't eat meat and milk at the same meal. And so there's become a whole idea of diet laws, which the, you know, very religious Jews observe. They have separate dishes for things with meat and milk, and they have to wait at least 6 hours between eating a milk meal and a meat meal, and they have different pots and different dishes and different sponges. And just like we have a Muchi sponge and a Suchi sponge, you know, they have a milk one and a meat one. And which was nice, because when I visited my mother's house, I could cook with her milk pots, because I know she never used meat, fish, or eggs in any of them. But anyway, it's such a distortion of the teaching. The idea is, you know, you're taking milk from a creature, how can you then kill it? Horrible. So, especially one shouldn't be killing the cow. Another very important, that's one of the very important points in this purport. And Prabhupada says here, a civilization which guides citizens to become animals in the next life is certainly not a human civilization. And that's modern civilization is pushing people to a life where they will become animals. In general. I mean, there are certainly people, most of them who are claimed to be religious people, who are trying to push the mode of passion. Be a pious person, you know, make your money honestly, have a nice family life, give charity, be a good person, worship God, that's mode of passion. but the push of society in general, the media, I'd say even the government, is pushing toward the mode of ignorance. Just do some job just long enough to earn your livelihood. Don't try to be a big material success. Spend all of your money on useless things. And basically sit around just wasting time. Mode of ignorance means wasting time. Watching television, playing computer games. That's mode of ignorance. You're not using mode of passion, you're at least using your time for something productive. You're taking care of your family, you're going to church, you're giving in charity, you're volunteering your time. That's mode of passion. You're very active, but you're active in something that's productive. But mode of ignorance, you're not even active. You're doing something that's useless. You know, take intoxication. Buy. As much as you can possibly buy. It's not even human civilization. Another very important point in this purport is Prabhupada talks about what is happiness. And he talks about, especially he's talking here about the mode of passion. Because in our modern society, and Prabhupada said this earlier, that formerly happiness was understood as a mode of goodness. Success was understood as a mode of goodness. And now it's understood as a mode of passion. I had to read an interesting book for school called Metaphors We Live By, which, really, really interesting book. It talked about how we use a lot of, you don't know what a metaphor is? When I'm comparing one thing to something else, and I don't use the word like or as. Just like I say Krishna has lotus feet, that's a metaphor. Krishna doesn't really have flowers for feet. His feet are like lotus flowers. But we say he has lotus feet, he has lotus eyes, that's a metaphor. So one of the metaphors they discuss is the use of up and higher. That in modern Western society, we consider if something's good, it's higher. It's up. And he said in a lot of societies, good is considered center or balance. So this idea that better means more rather than better means balance. A mode of goodness, of course you're going up, but you're very balanced. You're not always looking for more and more and more and more and more and more and more. Better and better and better and better and better and better and better, more, 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 more. The mode of passion, you're always looking for more and better. Of course, again, the devotees always try to do more, better service for Krishna, but that's a different thing. And we were talking about how the mode of ignorance means you don't do anything productive. So Krishna never does anything productive. What he does is called lila, pastimes. He passes the time. But that's obviously it's on a different platform. Right? You understand? So in the spiritual world, there are things that may look like passion or things that may look like ignorance, but they're all pure goodness. Pure goodness is not boring. Pure goodness is not boring. Pure goodness is not boring. So what is Krishna doing all day? He doesn't need to do anything. Chaturvanya mayasristam gunakarma vivarisa tasikartam abhimam vijikartam abhimam. Krishna doesn't have to do anything. He's just playing. And everyone in the spiritual world is also just playing. But that's all in the mode of goodness. Anyway, so modern society is always pushing, get more, get more, get more, get more, get more. And Prabhupada's talking about all the trouble you have to take for happiness in the mode of passion. He's talking about you have to build a big building and you have to employ people and, you know, the people are doing a lot of hard labor. And sometimes in big construction projects, people die even. There's so many miseries. So to get what you want, there's so many miseries. You know, there's something in the mode of passion to achieve your goal. Someone in the mode of passion is very, they're very fixed on the future. I think I talked about this before, right? Someone in the mode of goodness is very much fixed on the present. Someone in the mode of passion is very much fixed on the future. My happiness is going to be in the future, and I'm going to work hard now for the future. Of course, there's a peculiar thing about the future. You know what the peculiar thing about it is about the future? It never comes. There's no such thing. The future never exists. Right? Never comes. It's like this carrot in front of a donkey. So therefore, Prabhupada says a very interesting thing. He says, there may be a little so-called mental happiness. I have this house or this money, but that this is not actual happiness. So in the mode of passion, you're working hard, you're working hard, you're working hard, you're working hard. And when you achieve some of your goals, you get a little idea of mental happiness. Oh, now I've achieved my goal. The way I've thought of it is like a photograph. You take a photograph of your happy family in front of your house, and you look at it and say, I'm happy. But you don't have a feeling of happiness. I mean, even materially, have you ever had a feeling of just great happiness, just like inner joy? Some of my friends and I were doing some yoga for our health at one point. And I remember one time after we did our yoga exercises, I felt like I was just flooded with joy. Obviously, all my prana was circulating properly. Like, whoa, that's amazing. So that kind of happiness doesn't happen in the mode of passion. That's sort of overwhelming, just, oh, I'm just happy. I'm just joyful. I feel like I'm full of light and I'm full of love. And that's not the mode of passion. The mode of passion is, okay, I got my degree. Look at that. I put it on my wall. I got my beautiful wife and my handsome husband and see my beautiful children and look at all the things that they've achieved and they got this distinction and that honor. And in America, they have bumper stickers. My kid is an honor student. You know. Do they have that here? And then there's other people with bumper stickers. My kid beat up your honor student kid. But people, that's the happiness in the mode of passion. I have so much money. I have such a beautiful house. But it's, Prabhupada says it's not real happiness. He said this is not actual happiness. They're not experiencing any sense of satisfaction. Maybe for a moment here and there. And maybe for a moment. Oh, I got the house. You know, so maybe there's some satisfaction for a little while, and then immediately, oh, but look at, they didn't build this thing right in the bathroom. You understand what I'm saying? This thing doesn't work right. Oh, I don't like this neighbor. Oh, this is a problem. Oh, now we got to fix this thing. So there's just a sense. I mean, if we can try to access for a minute what this feels like. So happiness in the mode of goodness feels like inner satisfaction and joy. It's very peaceful. Happiness in the mode of goodness is more like this a sense of pride. I've accomplished something and a restlessness. I need to get more. And happiness in the mode of ignorance is, you know, you just lay around the house all day and you don't do anything. You say, oh, I just got to take a break. You know, you just, do you follow what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Or the happiness you get from, you know, watching a movie, or being intoxicated, being some kind of fantasy. So those are the, and of course we'll look at happiness in the modes later in the 18th chapter. But this is very important as far as our preaching goes, because most of what people think is happiness in this world is the kind of happiness they get in passion and ignorance. In our modern society, people don't experience a happiness of goodness very often. Sometimes, but not very often. And mode of passion, ignorance, happiness is what's being advertised as happiness. I mean, if you think of most advertisements, what are they pushing? Either passion or ignorance, isn't it? Have a nice family and beautiful house, nice car, good washing machine. Okay. Yes. Easy to slip to ignorance or goodness? I don't think so. I mean, ignorance and goodness have something in common. What do they have in common?
Not a big endeavor.
You're not making a big endeavor, exactly. You're not so interested in making a big endeavor. But the feelings and the desires associated with those are very different. I think what would be more accurate to say is that there's a lot of people in ignorance who probably think they're in goodness. I think that would be much more accurate. And I made this point on Sunday, don't use Krishna consciousness as an excuse for being in the mode of ignorance. And that's quite common. I'd say that's extremely common. That people think, even devotees, think that that their interests and their tastes and their renunciation even, which are really coming from the mode of ignorance, are symptoms of the mode of goodness. I mean, for example, if someone's married and they say, oh, I'm not really interested in taking care of my family, generally that's a mode of ignorance. That's not usually a mode of goodness. It's not because they're so filled with joy and happiness that they see the whole world as their family. If they were so full of joy and happiness that they saw the whole world as their family, they wouldn't mind taking the responsibility of their family. They just wouldn't be in, they just wouldn't find their happiness in their family life. Their happiness would be in their relationship with Krishna and their peacefulness. Whereas someone in the mode of ignorance, they just say, oh, you know, my wife's too much trouble, I'll dump her. Just like we see in the outside world where, you know, somebody has one girlfriend and then leaves that one and gets another one or doesn't take any kind of responsibility because it's too much trouble. I do see this with devotees a lot. You know, they'll read the books and they'll say, yeah, material life is so miserable and it's so much trouble. Therefore, I'm not going to do materialistic life. We'll read about this later on again in the 17th, 18th chapter. But that kind of renunciation is the mode of ignorance or passion. It's not goodness. You know, just laziness. The person in the mode of goodness is not lazy. They're satisfied. They don't have some big hankering. They feel like they already have what they need. They don't have a big hankering for anything. They're not lazy. But to go from goodness to ignorance, no. If you're really situated in goodness, ignorance is very repulsive. It's just like if you've been brought up in a very clean environment, then dirty environments are very repulsive. Don't you find that? And then I go to parts of the world where things are very dirty. It's very hard for me to be peaceful. I don't like it. I don't want to be in a dirty place. I find it repulsive, which is a sign of not being transcendental. Which we'll get to in a minute. But no, I don't think you can easily slip to the mode of... I think it's easy to slip to the mode of passion from the mode of goodness because a lot of the activities of passion are pious. The person in a very advanced state of the mode of passion, very pure passion, is interested in piety and religiousness and dharma. And it's very, very easy to fall into that. That's the main problem for people in the mode of goodness in this world, this pride that I'm a religious person, and to start doing their activities out of pride and for honor instead of just for truth. And once you start doing things for honor and prestige and position and in society, then that greed starts manifesting, and then pretty soon you're not satisfied and happy anymore. And then pretty soon you measure your success by how much you've accumulated. It's very interesting. Jiva Goswami talks about four or five results from willful, inattentive chanting. I'm not talking about the inattentive chanting that the beginner does who hasn't the capacity to chant attentively. I'm talking about somebody who's, you know, it's just like the five-year-old doesn't have the capacity to write properly. But somebody who can chant attentively and who intentionally chants inattentively, there are several symptoms of that. One is that they become a cheater. Another is that they'll gradually become an atheist. But one of them is particularly interesting. He says that one will measure one's spiritual advancement by one's external accomplishments. And you see this. People think, well, I'm a very senior devotee because I've done X, Y, and Z. I've opened so many temples. I've distributed so many books. I've waved so many sticks of incense. Therefore, I'm an advanced devotee. And they start, I've seen with people, especially people who are really aparadis, you know, especially people who are committing heavy Vaishnava aparad, that a lot of those people, interesting with a number of those people. There are many of them that are still chanting their rounds and they're following the four related principles, and they may be very strict externally. But you find that a lot of those people, they're not happy. They don't have a sense of inner happiness. And they measure their spirituality by external things, by external accomplishments. Does that make sense? So that's the measuring your success by external things is a symptom of the mode of passion. I have such a big house, I have such a big car. No, where there are many great devotees, just like that devotee who left his body recently in Vrindavan, Dadu, who just, you know, he delivered the mail for the devotees. He didn't have any big accomplishments. And if that's your service to have big accomplishments, then that's something else. Does that make sense? But that's a strong tendency if somebody is offensive. And if you start seeing that in yourself, if you start seeing that you're, well, yeah, I'm doing this and doing this and doing this, therefore I must be Krishna conscious, you're probably in trouble. I ran into this at one temple I was visiting. That was really bizarre. I was visiting this temple, and I think the second or third time I came there, this one brahmachari, great big guy, comes up to me and says, I'm the temple commander here. And he starts telling me his whole resume in Krishna consciousness. He starts telling me, I was at this temple and I did this thing, I was at this temple and I did this thing. And I'm thinking, why am I interested? Why are you telling me all of your external accomplishments in the Hare Krishna movement? For what purpose? Why are you even talking to me? You know, you can just say, hello, I'm the temple commander here, I'd like to welcome you to this temple or something, you know, that would be fine. But he was going on for about 15 or 20 minutes. And then he looked at me and he said, so what department are you in? And I just said, I'm in the troublemaking department. But that, to me, it was a really good example to me of that kind of mentality. So I think falling from goodness to passion is very easy, and mistaking ignorance for goodness is also very easy. Happens all the time. Okay. 17, get knowledge and goodness, greed from passion, and foolishness, madness, and illusion. Here again, Prabhupada says a similar thing in this purport. If one wants happiness at all, his money will not help him. He has to elevate himself to the mode of goodness. When one is engaged in the mode of passion, not only is he mentally unhappy, but his profession, occupation are also very troublesome. He has to devise so many plans and schemes to acquire enough money to maintain his status quo. This is all miserable. So I'd like to, again, think for a minute of what is material happiness? What is material happiness? It's a feeling of inner joy and satisfaction and peace. It's not spiritual, it's material. But that's material happiness. So even if you want material happiness, you have to come to the mode of goodness. And people ask all the time, can I have both material and spiritual happiness? Yes, of course you can. First of all, if you have spiritual happiness, of course you'd have the happiness that's in the mode of goodness. Wouldn't you? Doesn't it include that? Can you have the kind of material happiness that people have in passion, ignorance, and spiritual life? Well, not exactly. It doesn't really make sense. The mode of passion, not really having any happiness. You have an idea of happiness. When I was 13, I was babysitting once, listening to a radio show. And it was saying how the purpose of life is to be happy, which Prabhupada also said in a conversation in South America. And I thought, so am I happy? And I made a list of my accomplishments and my possessions. Well, I'm a good student. Well, I have a nice family. Well, I have this. Well, I have that. And I looked at the list and said, I must be happy. That's happiness in the mode of passion. You have to convince yourself that you're happy. You know, I must be happy. Okay. So 18 here is, again, a summary of what happens after death. And Prabhupada emphasizes here that you can't just go up. This philosophy of reincarnation that everybody's always going up is not coming from any shastra. There's no scripture that says that everybody's always going up. A lot of New Agey people say this kind of thing. Everybody's going up. Doesn't look like that to me, sorry. I don't see that everybody's going up. And Krishna doesn't say everybody's going up. Now here Prabhupada talks about, you remember in that other verse in 6, Prabhupada said in the mode of goodness you can take birth repeatedly as a scientist or a poet or a philosopher, right? And here he says that he said a person is not always pure. Again, I made that point. We're not purely in any of the modes. But even if he should be purely in the mode of passion, he will simply remain on this earth as a king or a rich man. So again, the mode of passion is materially speaking, for modern society, elevated. If you're really in the mode of passion, you'll take birth over and over again as some king or some very wealthy philanthropist. But because they're mixtures, one can also go down. He said the mode of passion is also the chance of becoming mad in the next life. So it is possible to go from passion or ignorance. And Prabhupada says, the mode of ignorance is described as abominable. The result of developing ignorance is very, very risky. Beneath the human level, there are 8 million species of life. And according to the development of the mode of ignorance, people are brought down to these abominable conditions. Their future is very dark. So, you know, you have to think, do I really want to live the life of a pukkika? You know, do I really want to have to stay outside in all kinds of weather? I don't know, I get to watch the pukkikas a lot because they live in my backyard or front yard, however you want to look at it. I've got the ducks and the pukkikas there. So, you know, I throw out some prasadam for them. And it's amazing. They're very selfish. They don't share. I know some animals do share, but they don't share. Even among their mating pairs, the ducks walk around and with, you know, male and female pairs. They don't share. They fight. And they'll fight. They'll really fight. And there'll be enough food out there for all of them. And they'll fight. And you're chasing each other. Sometimes in the mating season, there's 4 or 5 males chasing a female. And right now, it seems to be territory season, and the males are chasing the other males out of their territory. And the one who's being chased is screaming. You know, the other one's chasing him with his sharp beak. And the ducks are always afraid of the pukkikas. It's a really nasty life. Plus, they have to live outside. They're just drinking muddy water and swimming in the muddy water. And what are they eating? I don't know, bugs and grass. It's not a nice life. It really isn't a nice life. People are not afraid of this. To want to live that kind of life. They don't have a home. And some animals, of course, do have homes. But most animals only build a home when they're mating. They don't have a home generally. You have to just live outside in all kinds of weather. And if you're a prey animal, you've always got to be afraid that some other animal's going to eat you. I mean, we may have a hard life, but I'm not afraid that someone's going to come and eat me. I'm not worried that I'm going to be somebody's dinner. And if you're a predator animal, then you've got to worry about how to get your dinner. It's not so easy. As Prabhupada said, the other animals aren't walking up to you and saying, "Here I am, you can have me for dinner." And their digestive systems are designed so that they can go for long, long periods of time without eating, because they have to do that. You know, and their food is very nasty. And people don't take it seriously. What kind of life they're going to go through? And what kind of happiness can you have in those bodies? It's pretty sad. All right, then we're again here in text 19 that, I just want to make the point again that to know what mode you're in, you'd have to look at details, which we'll get to later in the Bhagavad Gita. What food you eat, you know, so many things. Okay, in text 19, again, we're seeing that's all that's going on here is the modes of nature. Just like a movie, all that's going on are 3 different color lights. That's it. It looks like there's so many activities and there's this thing happening and that thing. It's just 3 different color lights. That's all it is. And you're just watching. You're not really in the action. So here it's just the modes of nature are combining. Or we can think of it that there's just protons, neutrons, and electrons. Everything, what is going on here? It's just protons, neutrons, and electrons. That's it. It's nothing else. This microphone, this desk, this body. It's pretty amazing, isn't it? Protons, neutrons, and electrons. And from all that, Krishna makes water and air and light and noses and eyebrows and paper. Just from 3 things. I bet you none of us are that good of a cook. I give you 3 ingredients. You could just combine them to make all of the things here. And that's it, and we're just witnessing. Now, how do you understand that? Prabhupada says, unless one has the help of spiritual authority, he cannot understand in what position he's actually situated. So without a spiritual master, we can't understand that we're inside of a magic show. We just don't get it. in the section of the Bhagavatam I'm reading right now about Daksha. He said you have to be experienced. And Prabhupada says no amount of experience is going to help you. You have to have superior guidance. They say experience is the best teacher. We'd say properly understood experience is the best teacher. If you're misinterpreting your experience, then how is it a good teacher? You're learning the wrong thing. So I have one relationship and it ends badly and I think, I just didn't marry the right guy. I don't realize that this whole idea of trying to be happy through human relationships that are self-centered is not going to work. Doesn't matter what guy it is. Doesn't matter how many courses I take in human relationships. That's not going to bring me my ultimate happiness. So one has to understand that from a spiritual master who says, you know, hey, you're not this body. You're a spiritual being. You're trying to be happy in the modes of material nature. It's not going to work. Otherwise, you can't wake up. And Prabhupada says, for one who's able to see things as they are, the influence of material nature gradually ceases. Note the word gradually. But for one who's able to see things as they are, if I'm looking at a movie, and if I think about the fact that it's just red, green, and what is it? Red, green, and well, red, yellow, blue is subtractive colors. Light is red, green, and blue, I think. If I think that that's all it is, light colors are different than dark. Paint is different than light. Then I become detached. Of course, that's gyan. That's becoming detached through gyan. But in other words, if I see things the way they are, then I'm not going to be interested in them anymore. It's not interesting. How interesting are three different colors of lights playing on a screen? It's really not very interesting. It's only when I think it's something else that I become interested. Okay, and then Krishna says that when you transcend the modes, you can enjoy nectar even in this life. Prabhupada says that the happiness is knowing you're going back to Godhead, he said, but even in this life, even in this body, one can enjoy spiritual happiness. So, of course, there are many religions who teach, you know, you're only going to get your happiness after you die. Suffer in this life and go to heaven after you die. We say, no, you can enjoy even in this life. Okay, text 21, Arjuna is asking now, after hearing all this, now he's like, as I said, it's a good disciple. He's interested, thinking, I want that. I want that. How will I know when I get it? Very important question. I don't know if I've ever taught you ladies well-formed plan, but whenever you have a plan, one of the things in making a plan successful is you have to have the specific things that are evidence of achieving that plan. And we look at three things: behavior, thoughts, and feelings. So if I've achieved my goal, whatever it may be, if I've achieved my goal, how will I be acting? How will I be thinking? How will I be feeling? Otherwise, how do you know? It's just like if you say, okay, my goal is to go to Wellington. How do you know you're in Wellington? What's your evidence? There's some evidence. You say, oh, now I've achieved my goal. If you want to become good in some practice of hatha yoga or stanga yoga, there's some evidence, right? And you tell your students, okay, I want you to do this posture perfectly. They'll say, well, how will I know that I'm doing it perfectly? Well, your body will be in this position, right? And then how will you feel? You'll feel balanced. Does that make sense? There's some evidence externally and there's some evidence internally. Whenever you have a plan, always think of what is my evidence procedure in those three areas: thinking, feeling, willing. Behavior, thoughts, feelings. Whatever you want to achieve. That gives you two things. It gives you a means for how to get there, and it also gives you the evidence of when you've gotten there. So that's exactly what Arjuna is asking. What's the evidence? And he's asking in two main categories: lingai and achara. Lingai is internal, which means thoughts and feelings, and achara is action. Like we say, acharya. What is his behavior? And then he says, how do you do it? So what's the goal and what's the process? What's the goal and what's the process? Okay? And Prabhupada says that these questions are very appropriate. He says these questions are very important. Asking questions is a very important part of the process. Don't be dull. Pari Prashnena, one should ask questions. Sometimes people think, oh, if I'm a good disciple, I never ask any questions. No, one should ask questions. All right. Now, this is an interesting verse, isn't it? Very interesting verse. And you'll notice that this verse is very, very similar to what Krishna said at the end of chapter 2 when Arjuna asked a similar question. And also at the end of chapter 12. Remember when Krishna was explaining the qualities of the devotees? And we find, what would you say is the most essential feature of this description? A person is? Detached. Yeah, equal. And look at that. You're equal to the good stuff, too. I was just reading the 11th canto where Krishna is telling Uddhava. He says, don't get too caught up in this good and bad. He said, thinking too much about what's good and what's bad is also bad. You should transcend what's good and bad. Now, of course, I can't transcend things without first coming to goodness, so I've got to first figure out the difference between goodness, passion, and ignorance. If I think that something in ignorance is actually something in goodness, I'm never going to transcend it. So there's instructions for a lower level and there's instructions for a higher level. At the lower level, it's very important to discriminate what's goodness, what's passion, what's ignorance, what's good and bad. At the higher level, that very thing becomes an impediment. The very thing that's a help at a lower level is a problem at a higher level. Do you have other instances where that kind of thing is true? That what helps you at a lower level is a problem at a higher level? Can you think of any other area in life where that's a fact? Okay, what about learning how to read? So when I'm learning how to read, I look at the word next, and I think, next. Is that helpful if you don't know how to read? Yes, it's very, very helpful. Favorable. Is that helpful if you're learning how to read? Is that helpful now? No, I'd never get the Bhagavad Gita read if I was reading it like that. Dishonor. Yeah, I'd never get my reading done, would I? But that's very helpful for a beginner. Same with mathematics. In mathematics, I know that I can do 5 minus 3. I can't do 3 minus 5. But later on, you learn you can do 3 minus 5. It's called debt. People do it all the time. Or I would teach little children, don't ever start a sentence with the word because. Why? Whenever they started a sentence with the word because, it wouldn't be a complete sentence. They'd just write things like, because he was hungry. So I made a rule for the little children, don't start a sentence with the word because. But can you start a sentence with the word because? Of course you can. Because he was hungry, he ate all the honey in the pot. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains in Bhaktuloka, we talked about this in Nectar of Instruction, that there's different rules at different platforms. And you're harmed if you do the rule for a higher platform than you're on, and you're also harmed if you do the rule for a lower platform than you're on. Both mistakes can be there. So don't imitate a higher platform, and don't remain attached to the rules of a lower platform when you're ready to move on. So if we're at the place where we're not fully in the mode of goodness, where to speak of transcending it, then I have to think about what's good and what's bad. But as I progress in Krishna consciousness, I should be less concerned with that and more concerned with just serving Krishna and not so much concerned with the particularities of what's good and what's bad. I was just also reading that in Jiva Dharma. He was quoting from Raghunath Das Goswami's Manashiksha. He says, don't do the pious or impious activities prescribed in the Vedas. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, You shouldn't argue about the differences between dharma and adharma. And we find Prabhupada in the purport was saying eating a cow is worse than eating another animal. That's a fine difference, isn't it? But at a certain level of spiritual life, you're not concerned, is eating a cow worse than eating a goat? You're just absorbed in Krishna. So at a very high level of Krishna consciousness, that kind of thing will pull you down. At a low level, that thing will pull you up. Does that make sense? Right. A sad thing I see is that devotees who should be operating at a high level become absorbed in that kind of thing. Oh, what's good? What's bad? Was this better than this? Is this worse than this? And they forget about Krishna and Vrindavan, and they forget about serving Krishna and Krishna's form and Krishna's name, and they just become absorbed in this dharma adharma. Is that ignorance? Is that passion? That becomes their entire meditation. That's quite sad. And here Krishna says, one should be detached even from the good, even from illumination. One shouldn't even long for illumination of the mode of goodness here we're talking about, not spirituality. Like I told you, we were doing that yoga practice, and I had this like sudden full illumination. It was really nice. So, but if I'm longing for that, if I'm thinking, oh, when can I get that again? So then I haven't transcended the modes of nature. Then I'm attached to the mode of goodness. Or if I go to some dirty place and I'm thinking, ew, I can't stay in this dirty place. And especially when you're a traveler like me, sometimes you stay in dirty places. Hare Krishna. One time I was put up in the storage room. One time I stayed with a family that I don't think had ever cleaned their bathroom since they bought the house. So those were the two worst examples that I can think of. But you know, someone who's transcendental to the modes of nature. I mean, I'm affected by that. I'm thinking, get me out of this place. But someone who's transcendental, it doesn't matter to them. They don't hate ignorance. And that longing for it doesn't matter. Whatever situation they're in, as they're saying, they're not waiting for favorable or unfavorable conditions. This is explained nicely with Vasudev, when Kamsa wanted to kill Devaki. And one of the things it says there is that, I think it's a religious man, doesn't wait for favorable or unfavorable situations to do his duty. And you see also devotees who are at a lower stage in their Krishna consciousness, they're very disturbed if their situation isn't favorable. And they put a lot of their energy into trying to make their situation favorable. Probably like 95% of their energy they're putting into making their situation favorable. When one's transcended the modes, yes, of course you'd like to have a favorable situation, but you're not attached. Of course, if you transcended the modes, you're in pure goodness. So, yes, of course, you'd rather have a place that's clean and favorable, etc. But you're not attached. If due to circumstances you're in another situation, well, all right, let me be Krishna conscious here. If you get arrested by the KGB and thrown into prison and living in a place, you know, where nothing's ever clean and everything's full of rats, and then you can still remember Krishna and you still serve Krishna and you're not hating it. Say, oh, this is where Krishna's put me. So you read the devotees, they say they can go to heaven or hell, wherever Krishna wants them to go, it doesn't matter. What they're attached to is pleasing Krishna. So this is all equal. Detached. Now, my dear friends, we cannot be detached, unless we're getting a very high transcendental pleasure internally. You can't live without happiness. You just can't. And under my Vyasat, we're happiness-seeking creatures, like heat-seeking missiles, you know. We're designed for happiness. That's what we're designed for. So you can't artificially stay on this platform. I've talked about this before. It just doesn't work. You can't imitate this platform. But these are the symptoms we're looking for. That we go on with our service in all conditions. Yes, we should try to make our situation favorable. Put 10% of your energy into trying to make your situation favorable. But work at becoming detached. How can I serve Krishna in the situation that I'm in? And this particular purport I'm going to read through this purport, and then I'm also going to read you something else. When a living entity stays in this material world under the control of one of the three modes of material, and I should say, I read this section of this purport and this other thing I'm going to read to you also in a number of my seminars. I refer to this frequently because one of the big questions that devotees have who aren't transcendental to the modes of nature is, how do I deal with it? How do I deal with it when I'm hit by passion or ignorance? And if we're not on the stage of nishtha, we're going to be hit by passion and ignorance a lot. How How do I deal with it? How do I maintain my Krishna consciousness when I can't have the whole situation perfect? Okay, when a living entity stays in this material world embodied by the material body, it is to be understood that he is under the control of one of the three modes of material nature. Now again, remember I was talking about how each of the bodies we have is a particular combination of the modes? When he's actually out of the body, then he's out of the clutches of the material modes of nature. But as long as he's not out of the material body, he should be neutral. So Prabhupada's saying, as long as we're in this material body, the three modes are going to affect us. First of all, they're going to affect us, each of us, in a particular way. Because this, think of this body as like a filter. It's like a colored filter. If you want to think of the three primary colors, red, yellow, blue. So think of this body as made up of some combination of red, yellow, and blue. And everything that's coming into our eyes, ears, nose, is going through that filter. So what we perceive as enjoyable, as suffering, as everything, is coming through that filter of the modes. And that's the way that this body is going to be designed. It's the way it is. No matter how spiritually advanced you are internally, the body is still going to work like that. And the body is going to be affected by the modes. It's in the atmosphere. It's at the time of day. It's at the... So Prabhupada's saying, as long as you have this body, it's going to be affected by the modes. Just like as long as you're in a car. I don't care how spiritually advanced you are, as long as you're in a car, the car is going to act in a particular way. You can't make the car do something that it's not designed to do, except if, you know, if you have mystic power, you can make your body do something that it's not designed to do, but please don't waste your time with that. You know, you're a pure devotee, you're flying in an airplane, the airplane's going to fly. It's not going to go in the water. Your purity of consciousness is not going to change the fact that an airplane and a boat and a car are going to act in a different way. And the airplane is going to be pushed around by the wind, and the car is going to be pushed around by the wind, and the car is going to be in a traffic jam or not in a traffic jam. Certain times of the day, there's just like, why do you guys pick me up at 6? You used to pick me up at 7. Because at 6, it takes a half an hour to get here, or 20 minutes. And at 7, it takes an hour. It doesn't matter how pure we are. It has nothing to do with it. We could be totally pure. We could be absorbed in Krishna's pastimes. I could be realizing my eternal position as Krishna's necklace or whatever, you know. And it wouldn't matter. It's still at 7 o'clock, it would take an hour, and at 6 o'clock, it would take 20 minutes. Does that make sense? Okay. So same thing with this body. At certain times, this body is going to be affected by goodness, certain times passion, certain times by ignorance, certain modes. As long as we're in the body, that's the way it's going to be. So as long as I'm in the car, that's the way it's going to be. Unless I can, you know, make my car fly over the traffic. He says, as long as he's not out of the material body, he should be neutral. He should engage himself in the devotional service of the Lord so his identity with the material body will automatically be forgotten. Now, if you're driving the car, you can't totally forget that you're in the car. If you're just sitting in the car, of course you can forget. But you don't identify with it anymore. You think, this is not me. This is not me. I've had several very strong experiences of this. But in, what was it? Yeah, 92. So 92, I lost a child. And I went through about 2 months of grieving. And I felt like I was two people, one that was grieving and one that was observing. And I couldn't artificially stop grieving. In fact, I understood that if I did that, it would probably cause some sickness in my body. I had to allow my body chemicals to stabilize. But I felt like, you know, it was interesting. I thought it was interesting. That's just what the body does. You know, my body was preparing to be a mother, and then there was no baby to mother anymore, and all of a sudden it had all these chemicals for mothering with no place to put them. You know, I had to kind of reorganize the chemicals on the shelves. So one is detached. One is saying, it's not me. This isn't me. The people in the movie are crying or laughing, but it's not me. It's not happening to me. I'm neutral. I have my happiness elsewhere. When one is conscious of the material body, he acts only for sense gratification. When one transfers the consciousness to Krishna, sense gratification automatically stops. What am I mostly aware of? Mostly in material consciousness, I'm aware of this body. I'm thinking this body is me. In spiritual consciousness, you're mostly aware of Krishna. You're not really very much aware of the body. It says like an intoxicated person doesn't know if he has clothes on or not. You're hardly aware that you even have a body. I mean, again, we all experience this sometimes. We're so absorbed in something that we lose awareness of our external situation, right? Everybody experiences this. So what are you right now? You may be sitting here thinking about something totally different. You may be here just, you know, ritualistically. And then you're not even aware. You're not even hearing anything I said. You know, you're just thinking about something else. Oh, I got to deal with my mother later today. Oh, I got to go to the doctor. Oh, this is happening. My fiancé is going to call. I'm going to be getting married pretty soon. What are we going to do? My son's getting married in 3 weeks. And, you know, practically every time he talks to me, he says, it's so many more days until the wedding, you know. So we all have that experience, you know, right? Very common. I'm somewhere, but I'm not there. I'm not even aware. I'm in a crowd of people, and people may be pushing me and shoving me, and I'm not even noticing, practically, because my mind is elsewhere. And so that's... Then one doesn't care anymore about the sense gratification from the body. Prabhupada said, one does not need this material body, and he does not need to accept the dictations of the material body. Of course, again, that's someone on a high platform who doesn't even need to eat or sleep. But really, we don't need this material body. I'm not living because the body is here. The body is living because I'm in it. I don't need this material body. The qualities of material modes in the body will act, but a spirit soul, the self, is aloof. How does he become aloof? He does not desire to enjoy the body, nor does he desire to get out of it. Desiring to get out of it is sometimes a mode of ignorance, but often a mode of goodness, wanting liberation. Does he want to get out of the body? It doesn't matter to him whether he's in the body or not in the body. Because that's not where his happiness is coming from. His happiness is coming from his relationship with Krishna. Thus, transcendentally situated, the devotee becomes automatically free. He does not try to become free. If we're absorbed in Krishna, automatically you become free. Your consciousness then is in the body. You're then aloof from the body. It's just such a simple thing. And we all know how to do this. Every one of us knows how to do this. We can all be someplace and have our consciousness someplace else. Right? Does everybody know how to do this? We usually do this if it's something that either we're really worried about or really excited about. And our mind gets so absorbed in that. We may be doing things automatically. We're automatically cutting the carrots. We're automatically teaching our yoga class. We're automatically driving the car. But that's not where our consciousness is. Our consciousness is someplace else. So why do we have so much difficulty doing that thing that we all know how to do for Krishna? We all know how to do it. In fact, we do it a lot, don't we? How many minutes in the day are we doing that with something? Or my consciousness is absorbed in something. Really absorbed. Why is it so hard to do it for Krishna? Why? I'm asking.
I had a lecture about it again where someone, he told the story, someone asked that question, why is it easier for him to get absorbed fully when he's having sex? Why is it easy? He's fully absorbed, but when he's standing in front of the deity, looking at the deity, you know, he's thinking
of something else.
And then Maharaj said that because at the beginner state, or in the very neophyte stage, then the Krishna's material energy seems more significant.
What seems more real? Yes, Krishna doesn't seem real. Well, basically, what it means is we don't see that our relationship with Krishna is a source of our happiness. The things we absorb ourselves in are the things that we see are the source of our happiness, or the things that we see are a threat to our happiness. So if I see my house as the source of my happiness, then I'm very absorbed in my house. I've got to take care of this thing with the plumbing. I've got to buy new curtains. What kind of curtains do I want to buy? What kind of You know, like my son is thinking that when he gets married, he's going to be happy. That's what he's thinking. He's thinking, you know, as soon as I marry this girl, I mean, he's already been with her for 3 years. And as long as I say, what exactly is going to change after you marry her? But, you know, he's thinking, if I marry her, then I'll be happy. And because he's thinking like that, he's very absorbed in that. He's very absorbed in planning the wedding, and he's having the wedding in a distant place, and it's kind of complicated. So, okay, we're going to do this, and we have this part of the schedule, and this thing, and that thing, and that thing. I'm sure when he's working, that's in his mind. Because he's thinking that's where his happiness is coming from. Or it can be something you're afraid of, it's going to give you distress. You know, you're very worried about how you're going to deal with this person in your life. Someone who's acting as an enemy to you. You know, how am I going to deal with this person? They've said these bad things about me. Are they going to cause me trouble? Or I have to go visit them at 2 o'clock today, and every time I visit them, there's this problem, and this happens, and that. How am I going to deal with it? What am I going to say when they say this? Okay, what am I going to say? What am I going to do? And how long am I going to stay? Because we think that that's where our happiness is. So we have to become convinced that Krishna is a reservoir of pleasure. I'm part of Krishna. If I serve Krishna's senses, then I'll naturally become satisfied. And it takes a while for us to become convinced of that. Well, it takes a while for most of us to really become internally, emotionally convinced that Krishna is the source of my happiness. He's the reservoir of pleasure. And for that, what's hearing, and serving. And gradually, that starts to become our attachment. You know, first it starts with we become attached to the work that we're doing. I meditate on what I'm going to cook for Krishna, or how I'm going to teach the yoga class, or how I'm going to teach the Bhagavad Gita class, or how I'm going to clean the ashram, or, you know, I can become absorbed in that kind of thing. And gradually those things become a real source of happiness. And I start really meditating on that. Oh, when am I going to be able to chant my rounds? When am I going to be able to chant my rounds? When am I going to be able to read Bhagavad Gita? Oh, I remember that thing I was reading Bhagavad Gita. And that thing, and Prabhupada said this thing, and this purport, and Krishna did this thing, and Krishna did that thing. What about him? What's Krishna doing now? And what, you know, and gradually it starts to become like that. And when it's fully like that, then we've transcended the modes of material nature. Prabhupada also says something interesting here. He says he can attempt anything for Krishna, but for his personal self, he does not attempt anything. An interesting sentence. He can attempt anything for Krishna. So a devotee is willing to work hard for Krishna even in ways that apparently mimic the mode of passion. I mean, devotees work really hard for Krishna. Prabhupada made a big endeavor. That wasn't a small endeavor to come to the West. That was a big endeavor. Prabhupada made a big endeavor to translate books. He could have just sat in Vrindavan and chanted. He was satisfied doing that. But Prabhupada made a very big endeavor to translate his books, to print his books. If you read Lilamrita, Prabhupada spent about 4 to 5 years homeless, and another 4 to 5 years living at the Radha Damodar temple. And for about those 9-10 years, Prabhupada's struggle was incredible to get the money to print the books, to distribute the books, or, you know, earlier with Back to Godheads, and coming to America and coming on a cargo ship and not having a place to stay and gradually building a society. It was a huge endeavor. So Prabhupada says here that he can attempt anything for Krishna. And he says, but for his personal self, he does not attempt anything. What does that mean? Does that mean you stop taking a shower? That you don't buy toothpaste anymore? Now, there are great devotees who live like that. There was one saintly person that Prahlad Maharaj met, that Narada tells a story, that he didn't attempt anything for the maintenance of his body. He just lay on the ground, and whatever came, came. For his personal self, he did not attempt anything. There are devotees like that. Madhavendra Purit had some vows like that also. And there are certainly devotees who take some vows like that, that they're not going to make any effort for getting clothes or home or food or money. I know one devotee in the movement who told me, one renounced devotee, he says he never asks anyone for money, never makes any effort to get any money. I said, but you're doing so many projects. He said, well, I just tell people about the projects. I never ask out and out for money. He said, what to speak for myself, I never ask for money. So there are devotees who make no external effort, although I'd say it's unusual to find someone who makes absolutely no effort for themselves in all respects. I'd say that's unusual. But there are certainly examples like that of devotees who make no effort to get anything for themselves. So why should we do anything for, let's say, self, meaning the body and mind? Why should we do something? Why should we make any effort to do something for ourselves? Okay, there's, first of all, again, you have to look at lower platforms and higher platforms. You can't imitate somebody being on a higher platform. If you imitate, you'll get the opposite result. And I talked about how I was in one temple where they had these very extreme rules about separating men and women, where we had to wear a sari over our head like this so nobody could see our face. And if a man came by, we had to stick our face in the wall. I mean, it was bizarre. We weren't allowed to wear bright colors. We couldn't have worn a sari like that. You know, it would have thrown you out of the temple. Seriously. If we were doing deity worship, we had to only do deity worship when there were no men in the temple room. So I used to offer the noon artik, and the only thing I thought about the whole time I offered artik is has a man walked in the temple room? Because if he did, I had to hide behind the curtain. So I wasn't thinking about Radha Gopi Vallabha and Gaurini Thai and Jagannath. I was thinking about men. And I was thinking a lot about clothes. Are my clothes plain enough? You know, is my hair covered enough? And after several months of that, I thought, I'm only thinking about men and clothes. I thought, that's sex life. You know, what am I thinking about? I'm not thinking about Krishna. So trying to imitate something at a lower stage, it just has the opposite result. So if you say, okay, I'm not going to do any endeavor for my own self, guess what would happen? Your mind would go crazy. And all you'd be doing is thinking about things for yourself. Well, if I don't make any effort to get food, how am I going to get food? If I don't make any effort to get clothes, how am I going to get clothes? And all you'd be thinking about food, clothes, money, food, clothes. You'd be just in anxiety about it constantly. So someone on a lower platform has to make some at least modest endeavor so that the mind is peaceful. So that's one answer. Another answer is we may have some duty. You may have some responsibility, especially if you're a married person, you have some responsibility. You have to take care of a married woman's, for example, supposed to dress very nicely. That's her duty. She's supposed to do that. She's not supposed to look like a bum. You look like a bum when you're 70. You know, when you're a young married woman, that's part of the way that the man's mind is peaceful. Yes, it's all material, but it's necessary at that point. Now, the man wants to be able to come home and think, I have a beautiful wife who's trying to make me happy. That's part of his psychology. And part of the woman's psychology is she wants to feel, my husband is attracted to me. I know very many women where if the husband said, you know, I think you're really ugly, would be peaceful with that. Even if she is ugly and she knows she's ugly, she still wouldn't want him to say that. She wants the husband to say, you know, you're the most beautiful woman in the world to me. I once went to an educational seminar. And I can't remember if I ran to the husband or wife first. They were both teaching there. Anyway, one of them was teaching first, and they were really ugly. It was one poor person. It was really, most people are not ugly. You know, it's rare you find someone who's really, really ugly. But I was thinking, this poor person, you know, who would ever want to marry them? And then, like, a couple hours later, I had the session taught by the spouse who was equally ugly. I thought, you know, hopefully they find each other attractive. So, you know, some care of yourself needs to be there. That may be part of your service. Now, if you're pregnant, you have to eat nicely. You're taking care of the child. You can't just say, well, I'm not going to make any endeavor for my personal self. What Prabhupada says here, for his personal self, he does not attempt anything. You can't do that. It's your duty. One time when I was pregnant, I was at a meeting, and I was eating a snack, because in early pregnancy, if you eat often, you won't get nauseated. And I remember one of the GBC men who was there said, hey, how come I can't have a snack? I said, well, I don't think you want to be pregnant, just you can have a snack. But anyway, you have a duty. And ultimately, I was reading in Krishna book where Prabhupada said, taking care of this material body is also devotional service. So then it just depends on how you think about it. If I think this is Krishna's body, I have to take care of Krishna's body. I have to take it, you have to keep it clean. I have to keep it healthy. I have to keep it functioning. Just like I take care of Krishna's car. So then taking care of your body is not anything taking care of yourself. So I've got two answers here. One is that if you still think this is yourself, you may have to do something to take care of yourself so you'll be peaceful. And that's okay. It's okay to be where we are. It's all right to be where we are. Krishna is very happy if we're honest about where we are as long as we're making progress. Krishna is not happy with someone who's pretending to be something that they're not. I don't know any teacher who is. If someone comes to learn yoga from you and they pretend that they can do postures they can't do, is that pleasing? They just look foolish. If someone comes and they're totally out of shape and totally inflexible and they're honest about it, do you hate them for that? And you give them beginner's work to do, right? Because that's what's suitable for them. What would happen if you gave such a person, some totally out of shape, inflexible person, what would happen if you gave them the advanced work to do? They'd get much worse. They'd damage their body. So a good teacher wants the students to be honest. And he wants the students to be humble enough to say, okay, I guess I'm suited for the beginner's work. You know, if the student came and said, well, why are you giving me the beginner's work? Are you insulting me? Oh, you know. We're planning on teaching Bhakti Shastri in Mayapur, and they want to this year have two levels. One for people who really study Prabhupada's books and one for people who are beginners. And they said, we don't know how to advertise it. We don't want to call it the regular or the slow. Nobody wants to be in the slow group. You have to think of another way to advertise it. So be honest about where we are. And if I do have a lot of anxiety for the care of myself, okay, then do it. Then make some endeavor to care for yourself. That's the lowest platform. And higher than that, you care for yourself because it's your service. Actually, you don't care. But it's your service. And some people are not going to make any endeavor to care for themselves. If they're on the platform where Krishna's taking care of them, or they're in a renounced order, then that may also be appropriate. That's certainly, you know... Does that make sense? Is that clear? All right. So one who doesn't care about material pleasure and doesn't care about avoiding material pain, who is not interested in making an endeavor for themselves. By the way, one other point I'll say about making an endeavor for yourself, you can certainly experiment and see what you're comfortable with. You can try taking some area of your life in which you tend to make a lot of endeavor for yourself, cutting back on it a little bit and seeing if you can be peaceful with it. And if you can, then you know you can progress higher. It's just like you try a certain pose in yoga, and if you can handle it, you know you can do it. So you can try. You can stretch yourself and see what kind of things for myself can I make less endeavor for. Oh, I should say another point also is that it's very hard to make progress in spiritual life if you've got some severe imbalance in the body and mind. I mean, if you have a severe imbalance in the body and mind that you can't do anything about, that's beyond your control, then you accept that, you know. If you've got cerebral palsy, then what can you do? You just make advancement anyway. But if it's something that you can do, that's also important. That's part of your advancing in Krishna consciousness. Kind of like people who may do stretches as a warm-up exercise. So that may also be important. Not something you can necessarily neglect. And sometimes a person may need to get counseling or therapy or do some particular thing for their body in order to get things in balance. Otherwise, yes, Krishna consciousness will take care of all those things, but sometimes if you have a broken arm, you want to put a cast on it also. So that should also be said. All right, now I want to also read something which is a little unusual perhaps, but it very much relates to this idea that the modes of nature are pushing us up and down. Sometimes the mode of goodness is there, sometimes the mode of passion, sometimes the mode of ignorance. And, you know, Krishna is saying we shouldn't hate or desire any of them. And you might think, well, how do I become Krishna conscious when things are down? How do I do that? I mean, it's easy to understand how to become Krishna conscious when things are up. If I feel naturally light and illuminated and happy and peaceful, and I'm in a clean environment with friendly, loving people, and well, that's easy, right? So this is something from C.S. Lewis. I'm sure you've heard of C.S. Lewis. He's a famous Christian writer. He's most famous probably for the Narnia books. He also wrote a number of other books. And C.S. Lewis very much understands the position of a neophyte devotee. How much he understands the position of higher devotees, I don't know, but he certainly very much understands what it's like to be a neophyte devotee. And this is from a book called The Screwtape Letters, which is a favorite book of Jayadwaita Swami and Ravindra Sarup Prabhu, so I feel that I'm on safe grounds quoting it from time to time. It's a very unusual book. Screwtape Letters is a series of letters written from one demon to another about how to make a human being fall into Maya. And I found several things in that book to be of great help to me. Anyway, I'm not reading this exactly the way he wrote it, because he writes everything backwards. He calls God our enemy, and he calls the devil our father below, and things like that. So I shifted a little bit of the language. This is from in the 1982 edition. This is from page 36 to 39. Has no one ever told you about the law of undulation? You know what undulation is? It's like waves. So something that's undulate has a wave. As spirits, humans belong to the eternal world, but their bodies and minds inhabit time. This means that while their spirit can be directed to an eternal object, their bodies, passions, and imaginations are in continual change, for to be in time means to change. Their nearest approach to constancy, therefore, is undulation, the repeated return to a level from which they repeatedly fall back, a series of troughs and peaks. You can see this undulation in every department of life. Interest in work, affection for friends, physical appetites all go up and down. As long as one lives on earth, periods of emotional and bodily richness and liveliness will alternate with periods of numbness and poverty. So that's exactly what Prabhupada was just saying in the purple. As long as you have a material body, it's going to be affected by this moving of the modes. One must ask what use God wants to make of the dryness and dullness phase. So here he's looking at it from a different point of view. He's saying, how can I use the times when the bodies and mind is affected by passion ignorance? What use can I make of it? In God's efforts to get permanent possession of a soul, he relies on the troughs even more than on the peaks. Some of his special favorites have gone through longer and deeper troughs than anyone else. The reason is this: the obedience which God demands is not the absorption of a soul's will into his, but quite a different thing. He wants servants who can become sons. He is full and flows over. He wants a world full of beings united to him, but still distinct. And that is where the troughs come in. You might wonder why God does not make more use of his power to be sensibly present to human beings in any degree he chooses and at any moment. But the irresistible and the indisputable, something you can't resist, indisputable, something you can't argue with, are the two weapons which the very nature of his desire forbids him to use. So again, that was the desire to have living beings who are individuals. Merely to override a human will would be for him useless. He wants the living beings to be one with him, but yet themselves. Merely to cancel them or assimilate them will not serve. He is prepared to do a little overriding at the beginning. He will set them off with communications of his presence, which, though faint, seem great to them, with emotional sweetness and easy conquest over temptation. So this is, I mean, he's describing something from the point of view of someone who came to Christianity, but this is something that it's described universally. But he never allows the state of affairs to last long. Sooner or later, he withdraws, if not in fact, at least from their conscious experience, all those supports and incentives. He leaves the entity to stand up on its own legs, to carry out from the will alone duties which have lost all relish. It is during such trough periods, much more than during the peak periods, that it is growing into the sort of being he wants it to be. And I think about when my father taught me how to ride a bicycle. Any of you have parents who taught you how to ride a bicycle? Yeah? Most people tell me it was their father also. Anyway, so my father taught me how to ride a bicycle. And my father was opposed to training wheels. You know those little things that can fit on so it becomes like three wheels in the back? That was like against his principles. So the way that he taught me to ride a bicycle was when I was riding, he would Hold on. He was pushing it. He was holding it. He usually held it from the back. Now, what did he have to do at some point? Hence, the prayers offered in the state of dryness are those which please him best. He wants the living being to learn to walk and must therefore take away his hand. And if only the will to walk is really there, he is pleased even with their stumbles. Now, of course, Prabhupada says this. In the beginning of Krishna consciousness, one may not fully discharge the injunctions of the Lord, but because one is not resentful of this principle and works sincerely, without consideration of defeat and hopelessness, he will surely be promoted to the stage of pure Krishna consciousness. Sort of like this. And if only the will to walk is there, he is pleased even with their stumbles. Illusion is never more in danger than when a human being, no longer desiring but still intending to do the will of God, looks round upon a universe from which every trace of him seems to have vanished and asks why he's been forsaken and still obeys. Pretty nice, huh? Okay. So how do you do this? Arjuna is asking, how do you come to that state? One of the most important verses in the Bhagavad Gita, Mam chayo vyavicharina bhakti yogena sevate sadhanan samatitya cham brahma bhuyaya kalpate. The way you become transcendental to the modes of nature is not by faking being equipoised, but by always thinking of Krishna. And as soon as we get to the point where we're always thinking of Krishna and always serving Krishna without stopping in any circumstances, just like C.S. Lewis is saying here in the Trials too, even when it's really hard, even when your body and your environment is overwhelmed with the mode of passion and ignorance, when you're still serving Krishna, when you're still obedient at least, in all circumstances, then you're above the modes of nature. Now, some of us, of course, may get a glimpse of that from time to time, that freedom and that joy and that being above the modes of nature. But when we're at that platform all the time, generally that's gradual process. That I'm gradually absorbed and absorb more and more in Krishna. To be in Krishna consciousness or in devotional service means to acquire equality with Krishna, Prabhupada says, because he's saying here, elevated to the Brahman platform. So equality with Krishna does not mean that we become Krishna. But he says his nature, the Lord said his nature is eternal, blissful, and full of knowledge, and the living entities are part and parcel of the Supreme. Also saying. Anyway, there's a place there where it didn't mark it, where it says that the Lord has all opulence and that exchange of the six opulences is bhakti. Prabhupada says there's still individuality, otherwise there'd be no question of bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga has to involve a lover, a beloved, and love. So without that, does bhakti makes no sense if we're all one. Prabhupada says here that actually really to serve Krishna, he says you have to be on the same platform. If one is not situated in the same transcendental position with the Lord, one cannot serve the Lord. I was thinking of it even like a physical position. If you're standing on top of a stage, I can't serve you if I'm not up there with you. I've got to be functioning on the same level. So I have to be in... Ultimately, bhakti yoga happens when we're spiritually realized. Bhakti yoga before we're spiritually realized is practice yoga. Which we've talked about this before. It's real, but it's not real. You know, you get a beginning student in your yoga classes and you're teaching them, are they really doing things? No. But are they doing things? Yes. And they have to go through that. You can't jump over it. But they're not really doing yoga until they come to a certain level of proficiency. Does that make sense to everybody? You know, I'm in typing class, but I'm not really typing until I get to a certain level. But it says piling. You know, you're also called the heaps. you practice, and at a certain point in practice, you just get it, right? I'm writing this reading course, so I'm thinking about reading. You know, with little kids, you teach them how to read, and at first they're struggling this, and at a certain point, they just start reading. So once you get to that point, then really devotional service is going on. Before that, it's devotional service and practice. So it's real. Suffering's not real. All right, then you may say, well, wait a minute. Why are we just talking about Brahman? Why is Vishnu just saying Brahman? And he says, oh, Brahmano hi pratistaham, amritasya vyastacha, shasvatasya chadharmasya, sukasya ikantikasticha. I used to regularly go to educational conventions so I could become a better teacher and better school leader and see all the latest books and stuff that were available. They would have, hundreds of vendors there selling books. And I went to try different ones over the years, and I found that the ones done by the Christians were the most favorable for my service in the Gurukul. I found the ones done by the government schools, and there were basically three kinds: government schools, Christian schools, and kind of hippie schools. So I didn't get much out of the hippie school ones. They were like, if your kid still isn't reading at 13, maybe he just doesn't need to learn to read yet, and that kind of thing. They were a little odd. Although I could go there in a sari, and they really liked prasadam. You understand? And the government ones were not so helpful. The Christian ones I found very helpful. They had at least the theistic base. They were trying to teach morality. And they would start off, just like we start off our programs with kirtan, so they would start off their big conventions, like 2,000 to 5,000 people, with singing of hymns. And I didn't go for that part. It was going on in like the big auditorium. But I remember one time they were singing a hymn that sounded just like this verse. Immortal, imperishable, eternal, and the constitutional position of ultimate happiness. I don't know what hymn it was, but it was singing, immortal, imperishable, eternal. It was really amazing. I was like, I know that verse. That's Bhagavad Gita 14:27. But, they don't really go much beyond that. It's just sort of immortal, eternal, imperishable. So Krishna says that he's the basis of the Brahman. And that Krishna is, this proves several things. Proves that, first of all, Krishna is superior to the living entity. Both Krishna and the living entity are Brahman, or spiritual, but Krishna is the basis of spiritual. It also shows that Krishna is superior to the impersonal. And here, Brahman is described as sukasya ikantikasticha, the position of happiness, and real happiness only exists on a personal platform. The Brahman state is also not real happiness. It's just peace. Okay, so this section, again, we talked about a brief overview of the modes of nature, especially focusing on the goal, the result of each of the modes. Where do you go after death? What's your ultimate goal? And then discussion of what is the internal attitude of someone who's transcended the modes? What's their external behavior? How do they get it? What do they achieve? All right. And then next week we'll talk about trees. Okay. Questions or just nectar things you want to share? Yes.
Last week I was reading the 14th chapter, and I was really stressed out over my immigration papers that I had to assemble, and I was like, oh my gosh, I've got so much passion in me right now. And I was just reading, and as soon as I read verse number, the big one, 22 to 25, I read that, and then all of a sudden I felt such a relief. It just went away.
Very nice.
So much anxiety in my stomach.
And then just left. Yes, that's a very good example. So you were still making a lot of endeavor. Mm. It wasn't that you stopped making the endeavor, but what did you lose? You lost the anxiety.
Yeah.
You lost the anxiety. That's it. Thank you. That's a very nice example of how one can be endeavoring for Krishna, but not in the mode of passion. Thank you. Very nice. And how do you give up that anxiety? Because you know what? The result's up to Krishna. Thank you. What would you like to share with us?
One thing that I like, and one question, actually I have many questions, but limited. One thing one of the things that I like is text 19 in the purport. by the instruction of a bona fide spiritual master, a living entity can know his spiritual position, his material body, his senses, and how he's entrapped. So we, because I was thinking that often we see when we start practicing Krishna consciousness, it seems that we've got things that we didn't have with before. Aware of it.
Exactly.
And our spiritual master's helping us see.
To see how we were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I was just reading about the efforts of Rupa Raghunath Prabhu in Vrindavan, who's working with very, very poor people. So a lot of these people don't even know how to keep clean. They don't even know that they're dirty. They don't even know that they're dirty. It's also the way they've been. If you've been dirty your whole life, you don't even know. Right? You just think it's normal. Yeah. So the spiritual master comes and said, you're really entrapped. That'll get worse, by the way. It'll get worse. Take it as an adventure. It'll get worse. You'll see deeper and deeper things that are like, whoa, I'm really awful. Why do you think the great devotees, they say these prayers condemning themselves? You know, you're like, wow, pretty extreme prayers. But take it as an adventure. Okay, yes.
I wanted to ask, coming back to what I asked before, about, severe modes of ignorance, like, bun and Bibles and this and that. So Lord Chaitanya came to give Krishna consciousness to
everybody.
But in the practical preaching, we understand that we kind of bring a bun to the loft because otherwise that will do disservice to the other people that can actually take to Krishna consciousness.
Ah, so you see, in the ISKCON Soho, who here has ever been to the Soho Temple in London? You have? Okay. So they have 3 prasadam programs. They have a restaurant. A really nice restaurant. Well, you pay for the prasadam. Then they have a lunch program where bums come. I mean, all kinds of people come, not just bums. But bums are welcome to the lunch program. It takes place in the temple room. They have a class. They have a class, noon RT, and then they serve out free prasadam. And what they serve out are the leftovers from breakfast, whatever wasn't served out from breakfast. Sometimes they make a little extra, but generally it's just the breakfast leftovers. And there's no charge. People can put in a penny or whatever they want. And then they have the Sunday feasts. So they have 3, and of course they also do prasadam distribution in the city. They have a place at King's Cross where they distribute prasadam and where they work with people who are bums and drug addicts, and they even try to teach them a trade and things like that. So they have different programs for different people. You can't necessarily... I was just speaking to Veer Krishna Swami yesterday, and he was explaining that coming from the Uttama to the Majjhima platform to preach, when you're in the Uttama platform, you're not discriminating. You're not even aware of people's different psychophysical natures and different situations and the modes. You're just absorbing Krishna's pastimes. But in order to preach, you have to discriminate. You have to see this person is in this mode, this person has this nature. And one program cannot usually work for everybody. It just... different presentations, just like we went to that, what's it called? Park? What was it called?
Well Park.
No, I wouldn't give exactly that same presentation to everybody. So this depends on who you're talking to. For years, I had, it was most wonderful service. I got to preach to these Christian ministers who were in a seminary getting their master's degrees. And they had a course in world religions. And their professor, who was a great friend of the movement and who'd written a very favorable book on the Hare Krishna movement, I still keep up with him somewhat, would bring his class to the temple. Sometimes we would go to his seminary. At least once we went to the seminary. I went to the seminary with all my secondary students. And they did a kirtan, and then they also answered questions. So these are all people who are already Christian ministers. A lot of them already had a church. And many of them were preparing to be missionaries. Some of them were planning to be missionaries going to India. It was really a privilege to preach Krishna consciousness to those people. I only had about an hour. 1 hour to present Krishna consciousness to Christian ministers. I mean, and this is southern, I don't know if any of you have ever been to America, but the southeastern United States, Christian ministers, Hare Krishna. These are the real Bible thumping, you know, born again, everybody's going to hell except us kind of people. And that was my job, to present Krishna consciousness favorably to them. So my presentation to them, I mean, sometimes they'd even ask me, they'd say, well, you're quoting a lot from the Bible, do you always do that? I said, no, of course not. It depends on the audience. Yeah, so yeah, you have to tailor your preaching, is my point. And how you present Krishna consciousness to the bums on the street, and how you present Krishna consciousness to, you know, wealthy millionaire business people is going to be a little different. And you can't put all those people in the same room. Bhaktivedanta Swami said people want to see someone like themselves. I think I've talked about this before, how we tend to trust people who are like ourselves. It's very strong. If we see somebody who we think is similar to us doing something, we're much more likely to take it up. One devotee, one British devotee who married a Chinese lady who's not a devotee, was doing some service for me in China with the books that I'm doing. And in the process of doing that service, his wife met one of the Chinese devotees. And he said she finally started chanting now that she met another Chinese woman who's also chanting. Mm-hmm. Very typical. So you're not going to have, you know, very wealthy, sophisticated people who are not going to come to a program if they look in the room and it's all bums. Or conversely. You know, so therefore, there's different preaching programs. And therefore, be careful about criticizing somebody else's preaching. They may have a different audience. They may be preaching, you know, that's there. And I don't think that there's practically any of us who have all different sorts of preaching programs on our plate. I mean, I occasionally preach to Christian ministers, but that's not my main preaching. I don't do major, that's not, I'm not majorly involved with interfaith preaching. I know people who are, but I'm not. I've never done prison preaching. So, you know, we may not always have this. That may not be our sphere. And I can't do everything. I can't preach to everybody. So you take some... It's nice you have compassion. You know, and you do what you're given to do by your authorities. And if you want to do something else, you can request. And you can say, I'd like really like to enlarge the program and see what we can do. There's a whole group of people we're not helping. When I was in North Carolina, the temple came under new management. And one of the things we started doing was some strategic planning, which I've had a lot of experience in. And so I was leading the preaching group to plan strategies. And one of the things that we did was look at all the different audiences that were in the area. And we realized there were huge sections of the population that we weren't targeting at all. For example, North Carolina is one of the highest growing Latino populations in the United States. And I think like the number of Latinos in the Raleigh-Durham Chapel Hill area grew by 1,000% in 1 year. And we really weren't doing that many programs geared to that group, even though we had a number of Latino members of our temple. So and when we discussed that, then people started brainstorming. Wait a minute, you know, there's the flea market. You know what a flea market is? There's a flea market that attracts mostly Mexicans, and we should set up a table there, and we should be distributing Spanish books. And after that meeting, we started having a weekly class in Spanish, which we'd never done before. You know, we started just thinking, how can we reach this group of people? And one of the things I point out is we weren't getting the black people in the area at all. They weren't coming to our temple. I mean, we had one or two black body devotees, but we weren't going to, especially in the southern part of the United States, there's some traditional black colleges that were originally formed legally to segregate. The blacks weren't allowed to go to the same colleges as everybody else. But they've often remained black colleges. So we weren't doing any preaching program in any of those places. We weren't preaching to any of the black intellectuals of the area. You know, we weren't gearing anything towards them. And unfortunately, nobody really followed up with that. But you know, you can often see like that. What are our audiences? Usually, each project will have one or two audiences where you're doing a really good job with. Sometimes you see even, you know, we sometimes discriminate just Indians and non-Indians, but, you know, there are different kinds of Indians, too. And I've been in temples where all of the Indians who were coming in from Gujarat. You know, there's no Bengalis, there's no South Indians. It's interesting. And you'll say, well, what about one temple I go to a lot? I once said, anyone here from South? One person raised his hand. You know, and then I've been at other temples. I say, anybody here from South? And 90% of the audience. And sometimes that's because that's who's in the region, but sometimes it's also because people are gearing their preaching in a particular way, and it's attracting a particular group of people. Now, once somebody becomes serious in Krishna consciousness, that's not relevant anymore. It just doesn't matter anymore. But for that initial coming, it may make a difference. And yeah, you may have different, you know, at Bhaktivedanta Manor, they have certain programs geared just for the local people. They have one where they have a like garden day, where they take people around the garden, and they have strawberry day, open house day, and that's just geared for the local Western people to get them on the property. But that's not so interesting for the Gujarati members. You know, they're not really into the strawberry day. They're more likely to come for Diwali. So it's, is that okay? Yes. What would you like to add or ask?
Yeah, I'm confused about what is the difference when Prabhupada talk about the higher planet on this in the 14th, the pure higher planets. It's talking the difference between higher planet and pure higher planet. Is this material or is spiritual world?
It's talking about material.
Always. Because
no, not always.
Oh, no, but in this
section.
Yeah, because in the text 14 say,
yeah,
who died in the mode of goodness, he attained the pure higher planets.
Okay, pure. The word here is amala. If you look in the Sanskrit, amala.
Mm-hmm.
Mala means something impure. Mm-hmm. Mala can literally mean stool, but it can mean any... a mala is a necklace, just like you have papa and papa.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so mala is something impure. So that's like sweat, stool, urine, the things that are in Ayurveda, those are all called malas. So amala, where the Bhagavatam is called the amala purana also, the pure purana. So in other words, someone who doesn't have, and it says here, the word amala is significant, it means free from the modes of passion, ignorance. Now, as I said before, you can't have pure goodness where there's no passion, ignorance, sudha-sattva, it's often called, then there's nothing in it at all. That's spiritual. So there's relative degrees. It's degrees. Like we were talking about, you know, when you're in mode of goodness, do you take birth as a philosopher on this planet or do you go to the higher planets? Even in the higher planets, there's degrees. There's the Gandharva planet. There's Indra's planet, there's the planets of the Prajapatis, there are the planets of the great sages, and then there's Brahma's planet. And those each have higher and higher degrees of goodness. So I think I made the point last time that in one sense we're really just talking about one thing that we've divided into sections.
Mm-hmm.
So pure goodness is like pure light. And degrees of covering of that light I call goodness, passion, ignorance. So I was giving an example of that window. So the window over there that's clear,
mm-hmm.
that's like pure goodness. The window that's sort of the ones in the middle where light's coming through but you can't see a pure image, that's like goodness. And then if you made that colored, if you made that red, that would be like passion. And if you put the curtain over it, that's like ignorance. So they're all different degrees of covering. But still we have a demarcation. We make a line at a certain place. We say, okay, we're going to make a line here, and anything below this line we're going to call ignorance. And above this line we're going to call it passion. Now we're going to make another line here, and anything above that line we're going to call goodness. But they're all degrees of covering. So as I get higher and higher and higher and higher and higher, there's less and less influence of passion and ignorance. So you can call amala, and therefore you can call it pure. I think, you know, it's to us the word pure means, you even see, what was it? Ivory soap used to advertise 99.9% pure.
Yeah.
Just think about that for a minute. 99.9% pure. What does that mean? What does that mean? Does that really mean something? And if you think of the word pure, How can something be partially pure? It's either pure or it's not pure. Pure seems to be a one of those things that you are or you aren't. But we don't use the word like that. We say this is 50% pure gold. Like this ring is 14 karat gold. Well, pure gold is 24 karat. But they might say 50% pure gold. So the same terms are used, the same language is used, the same in Sanskrit. That the word pure is used for something that is not absolutely pure. I mean, even we talk about the pure devotees who can be pure, pure, and purest. With the purest devotee being Srimati Radharani. But again, there's a certain line above which you say, okay, now there's no more material contamination at all. It's gone. Still, you can say that the kind of love that the residents of Vaikuntha have is different from that. It's not just a different flavor. It's explained like Krishna's queens have some personal interests which the gopis don't have. But still, it's above the line, which you'd say it's all spiritual. Is that all right? Mm-hmm. From our perspective, these higher planets in the material world are pure. Mm-hmm. I mean, even Indra's planet would seem pretty pure to us, really. If you were to visit there right now, you'd say, whoa. I mean, sometimes describing the Bhagavatam, there's no lust or envy or greed there. It's not that there isn't any. But compared to the Earth planet, there isn't any. Is that okay?
Thank you. Other question about, you said when we are looking or watching television, is always is ignorant or depend on what's the topic?
Depends on what the topic. I suppose it could be other modes. But if people are watching television in order to escape, if they're watching television as an intoxicant, then it's definitely the mode of ignorance, no matter what you're watching.
And what happened with reading?
Same thing. If you're reading for an escape, if you're reading as if you're taking an intoxicant, then it's definitely the mode of ignorance, no matter what you're reading. But then there's mixtures. You can't just say, well, it's just ignorance. So if I'm reading to escape, but I'm reading, something about travel in foreign countries or growing flowers, obviously that's different than reading a book or watching a movie about people killing other people. So it's not, you're not going to find, again, pure ignorance, pure passion. You put something in a little box. It doesn't really work. So in general, something that's intoxicating, that's escapist, that's fantasy, that general thing is the mode of ignorance. Now, within that thing, there are the influence of the other modes. So just wanting to sit around doing nothing productive, that's the mode of ignorance. I don't want to do it, I just want to be lazy. Generally speaking, not always. Generally speaking, people who are watching television just want to be lazy. They don't want to do anything. I just saw this thing posted by someone I know. Okay, I'm going to stop wasting time doing this and I'm going to start wasting time doing something else. If you're wasting time, that's a mode of ignorance. But it may not be pure ignorance. Is that, it's not going to be pure ignorance. This table is pure ignorance. So there's going to be goodness, ignorance, passion, ignorance, and ignorant ignorance. And goodness, passion, 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 and ignorance, passion. And goodness, goodness, passion, goodness, and ignorant goodness. And all different, there's 84 combinations, not just three.
And if everything is under the three modes of material nature, including, for example, food, everything, what happened with the color? How the color affect us?
How did the color affect you?
If you use red, I don't know, I'm passionate.
You mean different colors of foods?
Yeah,
I don't know. That's a good question.
In general, different colors.
Ayurveda mostly looks at the tastes. Although I haven't read anything in Ayurveda about colors of foods. I mean, Ayurveda deals with colors of clothing and environment. Vastu Shastra deals with colors of environment. But I've never read about colors of food.
Yeah, I was looking in the database, but yeah, talking in general about the color.
Ayurveda deals with colors of, as far as the modes of food, it deals with the taste of the food. And there's two tastes, one in your mouth and one in your stomach. And things are, I used to teach Ayurveda. I used to have lots of books, you know, describing what position each food was in the modes. And it's according to the taste in your mouth and the taste in your stomach, how it reacts in your body. But color would be interesting. One of the most interesting things I read about color ever was some work that was done in the former Soviet Union with paranormal mm-hmm. psychic stuff. So there was a blind girl who was able to read with her fingers. She could just put her fingers over text and read through her skin. And she was some village girl. She came to the notice of the military, who did a lot of experiments with paranormal things. And they wanted to see if that was a skill that anybody could learn. They found that it was. They found that anyone has the capability of reading through. Don't waste your time doing this, okay? I'm just trying to make a point about colors. And they were trying to find out how many things we could sense with our skin. And one of the things that anybody could be trained to sense was colors. They did a number of experiments with people who were, you know, totally blindfolded, and that they could all sense, they could all be trained to sense what colors they were touching. And they were thinking, well, maybe different colors emit different amounts of heat. So they would put the colors underneath in a box with glass on top, and people would just touch the glass on the top. And what was particularly interesting was that everybody described the colors in the same way. So some of the colors they described as rough, and some as smooth, and some as like having peaks. And each color had a particular type of feel. In other words, if you touch something and they say, this is blue, and you touch something and they say, this is red, after a while people got to understand what the colors felt like. So there's something going on with colors besides what's apparent to us. That's my point. Oh yeah, don't waste your time with that, mm-hmm. please. We have a short human lifetime. But yeah, there's just definitely something going on with colors other than, you know, just I like this color, I like that color. Mm-hmm. They do affect you. What colors you wear, what colors are in the room around you. Definitely different colors have different effects of the modes. And different foods have different effects of the modes. Yes, what would you like to share? Huge what?
Turnip?
Fish?
Tuna. Yeah. And it was in the water with it, like it was dead, you know. Usually I'm not that compassionate, you know, like I've got things to do, you know, like you're gonna waste my time. And I thought I've been told in the past that, you know, if a person takes a book, that they get a chance for another human.
Yes. The way I understand that this works is that the material world is meant for two purposes, which we read recently. You probably said this is the mystery of the material creation. It's meant to facilitate sense gratification, and it's meant to facilitate us going back to home, back to God. Any step that you take in spiritual life is most likely not 100%. There are always exceptions, but most likely will get you a human birth. Then what happens to all those sinful activities that you've done? what happens to all the reactions to all those sinful activities? That's put aside, or it's reduced. Either it's like put on hold, or it's reduced. Because you've done something. You've taken some step. Again, we do this even in human society. If there's a criminal, even a very horrible criminal, but they take some step towards reform, then if it's a good prison, it doesn't always happen, but if it's a good prison, just that one step, they'll start trying to bring you higher and higher and higher, and then eventually you'll get paroled. It's very individual. So we talk about principles, but things are very individual. As a principle, if someone does anything in devotional service, even a small thing, then Krishna gives them a chance to continue, which means they get another human body. So even if they've done horrible, sinful activities, what's more important is that they've taken a step towards Krishna. That's counted as more important than all the sinful activities that they've done. Therefore, they get a chance to progress. And either they'll never have to suffer for those sins, or they may have to suffer just in a reduced form. That's the principle. How it's applied in each case, that's not really something I can understand. You know, when I look at you or anybody, I only see a little part of you. First of all, I can only see what you're like in this life. Second of all, I can only see what you choose to reveal to me. I mean, how much can I really understand about you? Whereas Krishna understands us as we are eternally, and he's able to apply the principles to people. So we can talk about principles, and the principles are real, but how they pan out in each case, how do you say? How can you say exactly how that's going to work out? But as a general principle, if someone does something for Krishna, they'll take a human birth. Maybe they'll have to see Yamaraj first, I don't know. You know, I don't know. It depends on the individual person. Not everyone who goes to see Yamaraj takes birth as an animal. In fact, even very pious people go to see Yamaraj, but usually he doesn't send the nasty-looking Yamadutas to get them. In rare cases, he even comes himself. But even King Riga went to see Yamaraj. He was a very elevated person who ended up seeing Krishna in his next life. But exactly how it applies, you know, exactly where everybody goes, it's very, very individual. Tailor-made for that particular person. Exactly what that person needs and wants and what's most suitable for them. But in general, Krishna takes any little bit of service much more seriously than any amounts of sin. Yeah. More serious. Well, no, it's still ignorance. It's just willful ignorance. You could say even it's worse ignorance. According to Bhagavatam, 5th canto, sins done with knowledge are much more punishable. I mean, even according to ordinary justice, it's like that. The more crazy you are, the less you're held accountable for your crimes. If you're not aware that if you're so mentally ill that you're not aware that you're committing a crime, punishment is very light. So the more you're aware of what you're doing, the stronger the punishment is. That's worse ignorance.
So
well, it could be. Some so-called atheists, you know, some atheists are mostly just innocent. They've never been in contact with anybody who could explain to them how God exists in a rational way. Again, it's individual. I mean, there's some atheists out there who are like, I'm going to try to prove that God doesn't exist, and I'm going to try to destroy God. They're like demons. That's very intense ignorance, motive ignorance. And then there are just other people who, they haven't contacted any philosophy that makes sense to them. So they say, you know, how can there be a God when there's so much suffering? Mickey, did you have something you wanted to share?
It's really hard thinking of Krishna 24 hours. And yeah, I am a so-called yoga teacher, but you know, it's really hard.
That's nice.
Thinking of Krishna.
Yes, yeah. You're seeing yourself honestly. That's very nice. That shows you're making nice progress. Very good. That's very good. Yes, it is hard, but it's also our natural position. It's what we are naturally. It's what we're designed to be. It's who we are. So in one sense, it's the easiest thing in the world. It's the most easy, natural. Everything else we're doing is unnatural. The reason it's difficult is we've become habituated to doing something unnatural. When I was in school, there was one of my fellow students always wore high-heeled shoes. And she said that she'd become so accustomed to wearing high-heeled shoes that even when she was home wearing slippers, she'd get high-heeled slippers. She said she just didn't feel comfortable having her feet flat on the floor anymore. So that's our position. We've started to feel comfortable with something that's harmful to us. And for her to, you know, go barefoot, she just hardly knew how to walk anymore. But walking barefoot is the easiest thing in the world. It doesn't take any work. So it's a very easy and natural thing. But yes, we become conditioned to something unnatural. So there's going to be some struggle. I'm not going to lie to you and say there won't be a struggle. There'll be a struggle. There will be a struggle, but it's worth it. And there won't be a struggle forever. There'll be a struggle for a while. It won't be a struggle forever. Whereas if you stay in the material consciousness, it's a struggle forever. It never stops. You're always struggling to get something, you know, that's always out of reach. So better a temporary struggle to get well rather than, you know, always struggling being sick. But yeah, it is hard. And if you're seeing that it's hard, that's very good. That means you're starting to understand where you are. You're starting to see that your present position is unnatural. See, if you've been wearing high heels your whole life, you may just think it's natural. Especially if everybody else around you is wearing high heels. And all of a sudden you start feeling, ooh, this. You know, you try walking on flat feet, and you're like, ooh, this feels weird. And you'd be starting to become aware of, just like what Lane was talking about. You start to become aware, oh, I'm entrapped in this world, I'm in passion ignorance, I'm not just thinking about Krishna all the time. I'm a conditioned soul. Whoa. I'm a materialist. You know, when I first lived in the temple, I moved in the temple ashram, and they'd give these classes about materialists. And I'd think, yeah, those materialists. And after about 2 months, all of a sudden, I was in class, and I thought, oh, they're talking about me. But, you know, they're talking about impersonalists, and I think, why are they talking so much about some group in India? Why? Who cares? You know, what do they have to do with my life? Yeah, those nasty impersonalists, you know. And again, it was about 2-3 months, you know. All of a sudden, I was just sitting in Bhagavatam class, and I thought, oh my God, I'm the impersonalist. So that's the beginning of clearing. And you're starting to get your vision cleared. It's a very healthy, good sign. Don't get discouraged. That's a sign of progress. You'll see more. Hare Krishna. You'll see more. Please don't be afraid of it. You will see more. And you'll see it's deep. Prabhupada says deep-rooted. It's deep. And you'll cry sometimes. You will. You'll cry sometimes. how contaminated you've allowed yourself to become and how fallen you are. So expect that. That's part of reestablishing a relationship with someone that you've hurt. If I've hurt somebody, reestablishing a relationship is going to involve some grieving. That's okay. It would be kind of odd if it didn't. Now, if I have a relationship with someone and I've been cheating on them, and now I want to reestablish my relationship, there's going to be some grieving. And there's going to be some frank honesty. And I'm going to become aware of how I hurt them. I just as an example, I had some email correspondence with this one devotee girl who wanted to be married, and she tried a few times to marry a devotee boy. And one time particularly really just didn't work out well. Somehow it was really just didn't. It was a very unpalatable situation. Evidently he was insulting to her and stuff. Anyway, so she never got married. She's originally from India. So she said, you know, I just contacted my parents and told them, just find me some Indian boy. I don't care if he's a devotee or not. She said, so my parents are now, you know, fixing up my marriage with some boy from my village who's not a devotee. And she started saying things to me like, I don't even want to see his picture. I don't want to know anything about him. I don't really care. And she said, I know he's not a devotee. And she said, but I don't even deserve to marry a devotee. Obviously, you know, I tried and it didn't work out. I don't deserve it. I'm just too much of a low person. And I had to say about 5 or 6 times in different messages, I said, so what you're saying to me is that you think this man's going to be a punishment for you. And you're marrying someone that you don't know, that you don't want to know, that you don't care anything about. And you're pretty sure you're going to be miserable, but you're considering that you deserve that. I said, now put yourself in his place. Does he want to marry someone who feels that way about him? I said, would you want your son to marry somebody who feels that way about him? Would you want to marry someone who feels that way about you? If someone said, I don't know you, I don't want to know you, I don't want to know anything about you, I just know that marrying you is going to be horrible, but it's all I deserve. Whoa. I had to say about 5 or 6 times. And finally, you know, she wrote me a letter and she said, I can see that I was just acting out of my own anger and hurt, and here I was going to make somebody else's life miserable out of my own anger at somebody else. So, you know, we don't, she didn't see that at first. She was so wrapped up in herself. So we don't see how we've hurt Krishna. We've really hurt Krishna. Seriously. It's not a small thing. We really hurt ourselves and we really hurt Krishna. And part of our purification is we start to see that. But that's part of love. If it's just some depressed thing, that's the motive of ignorance. Oh, I'm so fallen. But if it's part of love, Krishna, you're so kind to me. And so Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was praying like this, especially in the second verse of the Shikshastra. Bhagavan Kripa, your mercy, you're so merciful. Sarva Shakti, you put all your energies in your name. But Dura Daiva, I'm so unfortunate. I don't have any attraction. It's lamenting, but it's a loving lamentation. And here's somebody who's done so much for me and who's just loving and who's just kind. And I don't even think about him. I didn't think about him. And he's so kind. He's just saying, just think about me. I mean, if they do anything for me, just think about me. Just give me a little bit of water. And then we'll forget about all those things you did. Forget about the tuna fish. Forget about it. Just think of me. You can come home. And we don't. So that has to be faced. Definitely has to be faced. And it's painful, but it's a sweet painful. It's a sweet painful. It's exactly like, you know, you have some friend that you hurt, and you're coming and you're reestablishing your relationship with your best friend. And it's very sweet. It's part of love. So anyway, yeah, you have to see it. You can't reestablish a relationship with Krishna without that repentance. Again, I wouldn't reestablish a relationship with someone who hurt me without them having some genuine understanding of how they hurt me. And unless we genuinely understand it, how can we give it up? You can't really give something up unless you understand it, which is why there's so much of the Shastra explaining material contamination. You've got to see it for what it is. As Prabhupada says here, when you see it for what it is, then you can give it up. And for one who is able to see things as they are, the influence of material nature gradually ceases. I start seeing things as they are. I start thinking, I don't want this thing. I don't like it. I don't want to be that kind of person. Like this girl wrote to me, she said, how could I be so selfish? She said, I don't believe I was so selfish. I was about to ruin another person's life. And as soon as she saw that, the moment she saw that, she was able to step back and say, I don't want to do this anymore. Immediately. But until she saw it, she couldn't do it. Does that make sense? Yes, did you have something you wanted to share?
Given so much in your class. I wrote down some quotes.
Oh, ask one thing. And someone here, this is for you, for teaching 14th chapter.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
So how can we, how Prabhupada says that one just can attempt anything for Krishna, but for his personal self he does not attempt anything.
It may be something you need to aspire for.
So, for the personal self, not doing anything.
It may be something that you can. Again, I think that's true on many levels. First of all, if you're a neophyte, if you're a beginner, there may be some things you need to do for yourself that will help you in your Krishna consciousness. At least you connect it with your Krishna consciousness. I'm doing this thing for myself so I can be a better devotee. So my mind can be peaceful, and that's okay. On a little higher level, I may be doing things for myself because it's my service, and it may be by service because, again, that's the level of Krishna consciousness that I'm at. I may be at a level where I need to have a family, and a family, like I was giving an example, you have to do things for yourself. You have to. A married woman has to dress nicely. That's her duty. It is. It's her duty. It's part of her service. Now, part of that is service, and part of that is our own attachment to the material world, but that's okay. You have to be where you are. And then a higher level than that is, I take care of this body just to please Krishna. This is not mixed with anything for myself. I just do the what's needed to please Krishna. And that may mean, like Prabhupada took hour and a half massage every day and an hour walk every day to keep his body fit for service. But his mood was just, I'm doing this to please Krishna, not I'm doing it for myself. So in the beginning, very beginning, I'm mostly doing it for myself. A little higher, it's very mixed. I'm doing something for myself and it's also service. Higher than that, I'm doing it just in Krishna's service. And sometimes there are pure devotees who don't externally do anything for themselves at all. Nothing. That's rare. And that isn't higher, it's just different. So there are some devotees who live as avadutas and make no external endeavor for anything for their body and mind. I mean, Prabhupada did not do that. You can't really do that and preach very well. It's pretty hard. But there are ways in which you can do it. And again, I know of devotees who, at least in certain areas of their life, don't make any endeavor for certain things for themselves. It depends on what your service is. If you're a householder man who doesn't make any endeavor to earn a livelihood, is probably in the mode of ignorance, not transcendental. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went to Srivastakura's house. He says, you're not doing anything to earn a living. He said, you're a householder, you have to earn a living. And Srivastakura said, I have a 1-2-3 policy. But Chaitanya said, what is this 1-2-3 policy? He says, if no one gives me any money, one day we'll fast, 2 days we'll fast, 3 days we'll fast, and if no one's giving me any money by the third day, I'll jump in the Ganges. And Lord Chaitanya said, don't worry, I'll have Lakshmi Devi personally come and take care of you. That's very unusual. And generally, a householder, it's his duty. Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, that's his duty to make an endeavor to make money. That's his duty. That's not the duty of someone who's renounced. So brahmachari, vanaprastha, and sannyasi should not be doing anything to make money. At all. Whatever money comes, comes. But even a grihastha, they should be doing their duty, and then whatever comes, comes also. It's just their duty is different. So their duty is to work a job. They have some kind of business, they do an honest livelihood, and whatever comes, comes. Madhavendra Puri made no effort to get food. He wouldn't beg. Generally, people in the renounced order can beg. In fact, they're called beggars. We were just reading that in the Bhagavatam. They're the order of beggars. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself as a sannyasi would beg. That's making some effort to take care of yourself. They would go from door to door begging. Prabhupada said they did that to enlighten the householders. But they also did that to maintain their bodies, frankly. Raghunath Das Goswami made some effort. He got the old rice that the cows had left, but he was making some effort. Madhavendra Puri made no effort. He only took food that came to him without begging. So, you know, there's different devotees may do things in different ways. I don't know if he made efforts to get clothes. Well, as I say, even Chaitanya Mahaprabhu as a sannyasi, he was making some effort in the sense that he was begging. He'd go, you know, give me alms, give me alms, give me alms. That's the general mode of the renounced persons. The highest platform is, I do my duty according to my varna and ashrama only to please Krishna. And whatever results come for me, they come. And whatever results don't come, come. That's the highest platform. You can try seeing if you can do that a little in some area of your life. Pick one area of your life where you're really attached and let go of it. And say, okay, Krishna, I'm going to do my duty. And whatever comes to me in this regard comes. And whatever doesn't come, doesn't come. See if you can do it. If you can do it, it's a lot of fun. But you do your duty. Your duty may be going to work. Your duty may be begging from door to door. You have your duty. But then you're not making an effort for yourself. You're making an effort to do your duty. Does that make sense to you? Sort of.
I'm just thinking about duty because that's the duty in Prabhupada's books, like with, you know, what the wife is supposed to do. That's the duty of the spiritual master, what service they've given you. Like, how do you balance the duty?
That's described in what, 9:30. In the famous Apichet Sutaracharo verse. As for protecting the body or abiding by the rules of society and state, certainly there are different activities, even for the devotees, in connection with the conditioned life. And such activities are called conditional. So you have some duty to protect your body. Very advanced devotees may not do anything to protect their body. Sometimes. Even for the devotees, in connection with the conditioned life, such activities are called conditional. Besides this, the living entity was fully conscious of his spiritual nature. Fully conscious of his spiritual nature. That's a very high platform. As engaged in Krishna consciousness or devotional service of the Lord, has activities which are called transcendental. Such activities are performed in his constitutional position, and they are technically called devotional service. Now, in the conditioned state, sometimes devotional service and the conditioned service in relationship to the body will parallel one another. But then again, sometimes these activities become opposed to one another. As far as possible, a devotee is very cautious so that he does not do anything that would disrupt his wholesome condition. So we have two activities, one in relationship to this body that involves protecting the body, and that's also our duty. That's our conditional duty. We have those duties because we're material life, and then we have the duties that are according to our constitutional position. Those are the duties given by the spiritual master. And Prabhupada says that usually they parallel one another. In other words, usually they're in harmony with one another. He said, but sometimes they become opposed to one another. He said, the devotee is very careful not to do anything that will disrupt his wholesome condition. Wholesome condition. So you're taking care of both. But the point of this verse is that sometimes a devotee, in doing his spiritual duties, ends up doing something that, from a material point of view, is not very nice. So sometimes, in order to take care of the spiritual duties, something in the material duty is neglected. You know, my mother was not very happy that I joined the Krishna consciousness movement. And from a Vedic point of view, I was supposed to obey my mother. I wasn't supposed to just disobey her like that. But I did that, something that's considered abominable, for the sake of spiritual life. So try to have them parallel one another. Generally, they should be able to parallel one another, because even our material duties are given in the Shastra, and the Shastra is given by Krishna. Generally speaking, the activities for spiritual life and the activities to spiritualize our material life should be in harmony. They're given by the same person for the same reason, but sometimes they're not. When they're not, we choose the spiritual. But again, I'm going to say, don't be in the mode of ignorance with the excuse of Krishna consciousness. Don't use Krishna consciousness as Arjuna was trying to do in the Bhagavad Gita, as an excuse for neglecting your material duties. Be careful. Be insightful. What is my motivation? What's really driving me? Am I really just neglecting, am I really doing something neglectful on the material platform because I'm in a higher state of consciousness and to please Krishna? Or am I using Krishna as an excuse to be lazy and negligent and nasty? And I've seen a lot of that in myself and in so many people. Somebody yelling at their husband because this or that. Why aren't you more Krishna conscious? I just want to be Krishna conscious. And then the man legitimately looks at his wife and says, well, you're sure not acting like that. You're not acting like a Krishna conscious person. So, be careful. But anyway, having said that, you're better off, even if you make a mistake, choosing the spiritual over the material. Even if you mess up, and even if you do it wrong, Krishna's happy with your effort. And he'll rectify you in time. It says that in the Bhagavatam, if you do one thing in pure consciousness, even if the rest of your life is a mess, your life is successful. Whereas if the rest of your life is all together and you haven't achieved anything spiritual, it's a useless waste of time. So if you have a choice between the material and the spiritual, even if you're not sure what your motives are, choose the spiritual. You'll be on the safer road. But also be introspective, please. Otherwise, you may lament later for false renunciation and cruelty to others in the name of Krishna consciousness. I'm going to neglect you and be mean to you in the name of my service. Okay, thank you very much.